Okay, pursuant to House Rule 10.01, I call Human Services Finance and Policy to order. Today, members, we have a full agenda. We have six bills up, so we will be spending roughly 15 minutes on each bill. That means we'll be limiting testimony to 2 minutes for each testifier, and I'm going to initially limit the number of questions to one question per member. And note that, members, if these bills appear in our Human Services Omnibus, we'll have another chance to take more questions and amendments. And with that, I'll ask Ms. Hansen to take the roll, please.
Mm-hmm. Chair Schultz.
Present.
Vice Chair Bonner. Lead Albright.
Present.
Representative Bolden.
Present.
Representative Burkle.
Present.
Representative Fisher.
Fisher, present.
Representative Frederick.
Present.
Representative Hansen. Representative Keel. Representative
present. Liebling. Oh, sorry.
That's okay, thank you. Representative Liebling.
Liebling, present.
Thank you. Representative Mueller.
Present.
Representative Knorr. Representative Novotny.
Novotny, present.
Representative Pearson.
Pearson, present.
Representative Pinto.
Present.
Thank you. Representative Rasmussen.
Rasmussen, present.
Representative Robbins. I think she's coming soon. Representative Sandel.
Present.
Representative Schumacher. Thank you, members.
Okay, members, we have a quorum. Thank you. Thank you for joining us at 8:30 this morning. And just a reminder, we're going to break at 10, recess, and then come back at 10:30 to take up two bills from Representative Edelson on background studies, and then to start our discussion on the governor's budget and supplemental budget. Okay, let's see. Vice Chair Bonner, would you like to move the minutes from March 19th?
Yes, Madam Chair, I'd like to move the minutes from March 19th, 2020.
Thank you. Representative Bonner moves the minutes. Any discussion of the minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor of approving the minutes from March 19th, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? Okay, the motion prevails and the minutes are approved. Okay, so the first bill for consideration is House File 312. So I'll move House File 312 so it's in front of the committee. And this bill will be laid over for possible inclusion in our Human Services Finance Bill. Welcome back, Representative Becker-Finn. It looks like you have an A4 amendment. Would you like for me to move that amendment?
Yes, please, Madam Chair.
Can you describe it briefly?
Yep. So the A4 amendment is mostly cleaning up some things, as well as extending the deadline for when the bill would be imposed, and then also changing the funding to DHS a bit. And I can talk about that more when I talk about the bill.
Okay, so I'll move the A4 amendment on House File 312. All those in favor of moving the A4 amendment, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? Okay, the motion prevails and the A4 amendment is adopted. Okay, to your bill, Representative Becker-Finn.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members, for hearing this important bill. I know you have a really full agenda, so I'm going to keep my comments pretty focused. The question before you in House File 312 is whether parents with low incomes should be appointed an attorney when facing termination of their parental rights. As the law stands now, the court shall appoint counsel in any case in which it feels that such an appointment is appropriate if the person is financially unable to pay for their own attorney. And this feels that language is both very permissive and subjective, and honestly a bit unusual when it comes to language for the courts. The second part of the bill, and the reason the bill is in front of your committee, addresses the issue of how these attorneys would be paid and where those funds would come from. It's admittedly been a very difficult nut to crack. So these attorneys were initially funded through the Public Defender's Office was picking up the tab for that, but it's now been over a decade since the Public Defender's Office stopped doing that. Counties have been figuring out different ways to pay for that. And so what the A4 amendment did is fund some positions within DHS to help counties access federal 4E funds. Hennepin County has been very successful in being able to do that. And so that's what the A4 amendment does, and that's where the funding would be through DHS, so that the counties would be able to access additional funds through those federal dollars. And then once that gets set up, that would be an ongoing funding source for them. And I do have a testifier, and I want to make sure we have time for her, and then I'm available for questions. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Becker-Finn. The first testifier we have is Adrian Baker. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Hello. Good morning. My name is Adrian Baker. Thank you for having me here today. I'm a law student at Mitchell Hamlin School of Law, and I'm also work with the Institute to Transform Child Protection as a policy student. I'm here to testify before you today to give you a brief background of the parent representation bill. This bill would require the appointment of an attorney for indigent parents in child welfare cases. And currently, Minnesota does not mandate appointment for counsel for parents in child protection cases. So many parents in Minnesota are, as a result, not represented at that initial hearing after their child has been removed from their home. Additionally, Representative Becker-Finn indicated, different counties provide representation to parents in different ways, and ultimately this inconsistency is harmful to families. Research is clear: when parents have well-trained attorneys from the first hearing on, children do better in the longer term, and they remain home in more stable reunifications than when parents do not have legal representation. Over the past 8 months, we have worked closely on this parent representation bill with numerous stakeholders, including county attorneys, parent attorneys, the judiciary, and Minnesota Association of Counties. During this time, we developed two working groups regarding budget and logistics to consider all perspectives. And ultimately, we appreciate the dynamic and collaborative effort to make this important initiative a reality for families across Minnesota. Thank you. My professor, Joanna Woolman, is available to answer questions on this bill.
Thank you, Ms. Baker. The second testifier we have is Matt Freeman. Welcome, Mr. Freeman. Please state your name and affiliation and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Matt Freeman. I'm the Executive Director for the Minnesota Association of County Social Service Administrators, MACSA, and representing human service directors in all 87 counties. Here to testify on behalf of MACSA and the Association of Minnesota Counties. As Representative Becker-Finn stated, since 2008, parental representation has been an unfunded mandate to counties, which has resulted in some variability across the state in how representation is achieved. And that variability is related to resources as well as access to parental attorneys. Counties recognize the worthwhile intents of this legislation if it's correctly implemented. We recognize remaining issues with program administration, recruitment and retention of qualified and culturally competent attorneys, costs to implement and maintain the recommended requirements, and division of funding between the state and counties for contracting for those services. Our concerns with the bill as introduced are outlined in a letter, but I want to speak specifically to the A4 amendment that's presented today. That amendment strips the bill of funding for counties that pay for expansion of an already unfunded mandate. In our discussions with the work group and with the Institute to Transform Child Protection, there was a commitment to include funding with the proposal so as not to expand that unfunded mandate and address the disparities across our state. Going as far as the Institute assuring counties in conversations that they would not be interested in moving forward the provision without funding. Institute has represented to us that one of the barriers to including funding to counties lies in challenges with DHS administering the initial proposed funds to counties. We'd be interested in finding a different agency or a different location if that is the challenge. I also want to highlight that though federal Title IV-E funding is presented as a way to alleviate this cost, implementation of federal 4E funding is an uncertain, incomplete, and administrative burdensome reimbursement source for EPC hearings. In 2019, federal policy changed to create a potential partial financial resource through the federal Title IV-E for some parental representation. However, this only provides reimbursement at a rate of less than 50% of the administrative expenditures for representation of a child, and only if they are Title IV-E eligible, potentially providing only a portion of for the cost. We expect a large number of children will not be Title IV-E eligible. That's our experience. Informally, I've been told that 30% eligibility would be a strong number in counties. And so 50% of that 30% leaves a significant amount of that not funded. So applying for reimbursement through 4E is an administratively intense task, and navigating this new funding is a costly administrative obligation. Hennepin County is currently engaging in a pilot to explore this new opportunity, but as of now, no counties have yet seen Title IV-E reimbursements received. Hennepin County has billed, but has not yet received dollars, is my understanding. And this is more than a year after the eligibility requirements were amended. So for Human Services, the additional administrative effort to verify eligibility comes with no additional funding. The funds that will be received for 4E go towards the representation. Thus, Human Services staff will go away from administering programs and working towards meeting this administrative requirement. My understanding that in Hennepin County, Human Services has had to add a full-time employee to administer paperwork to satisfy their needs for applying for the Title IV-E funding within the pilot. So funds received don't, again, go back to Human Services, but towards mitigating the cost of attorneys. And for counties with less resources, this means taking on administrative burden of applying for those funds directly affecting Human Service budgets. I'd also like to raise up concern that although attorneys are ultimately administered by the courts, Max is concerned that the shortage of parental attorneys across the state may create challenges in scheduling and result in delayed permanency for children, which creates a concern from a Human Service standpoint. Happy to take questions, but lastly, from MAXA, a dedicated funding source is really a necessary part of reforming parental representation, and really encourage the committee to include that in this bill to adequately allow us to address representing the legal interests of parents.
Thank you, Mr. Freeman. Representative Becker-Finn, can you talk about the appropriation and then if you wanted to follow up with some of the testimony?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And as the last testifier noted, since 2008, this has been an unfunded piece that counties have to deal with. So I just want to note that currently right now, counties receive $0 from the state to pay for these attorneys. And so I think it's, as I said, it's been a really difficult nut to crack because it's actually been further complicated by McKenna's law. Folks will remember that, that passed a couple of years ago, which is a great, great law that requires counsel through the public defender's office for children who are 10 or older in these proceedings. And it makes it much more difficult to appoint than to also appoint a public, you know, so we couldn't just go straight back to going to appointing public defenders to represent the parents because the public defenders are already representing the children. We have talked to, we have looked at a tax way to pay for this. We have looked at We have talked to DHS, the Office of Justice Programs, the courts, the guardian ad litem, the public defenders. There is just not a perfect option of where to house this. And I think long term, we do all need to start thinking about an Office of Parent Representation, which is how other states have done it. But in the meantime, you know, every single one of these hearings that happens without an attorney present is really a burden and, you know, is can really a lot of trauma for children and families. And I do want to note that I do want to correct that Hennepin County has received $1 million in federal 4E funds. It was a pilot project, but it's been very successful. And that is one of the reasons that the A4 amendment is funding DHS to help other counties figure out how to access those funds. And Hennepin County has received the funds. So it is working. We've figured it out. It was certainly a challenge for that county initially, but the hope is that with some DHS staff able to assist counties, you know, having that be a full-time position, that they would be able to help other counties access those funds as well.
Thank you, Representative Becker-Finn. It looks like the appropriation is $192,000 in the first year and then $215,000 in 2023. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is there anyone on the call this morning from DHS?
Representative Albright, this is,
okay.
This is Lisa Bailey. I am on the phone.
Thank you. Commissioner Bailey, please stay with us. Representative Albright, can you state your one question, please?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I understand in the testimony from both the MACSA as well as from Representative Becker-Finn with regard to the Hennepin County pilot program, a number of the advocates have said that your agency has a conflict of interest in terms of how to administer it. And we've been, obviously, as Representative Becker-Finn stated pretty quickly, not too many other places to house this. So how do you intend to resolve this, or are you still able to resolve it? It certainly seems like the conflict of interest has not gone away, so we're still sitting with an unresourced and unfunded county mandate. How would you respond to that?
Ms. Bailey?
Chair Schultz, Representative Albright, the department strongly represents, first of all, the concept and the need for this high-quality parent representation in these child protection matters. And in terms of the 4E, the assistance with allowing counties to draw down those 4E funds, we think that is something that's workable. That's something that we've been doing this year, as Mr. Freeman noted, in a pilot project and has been quite successful, and we would need those additional staff to assist with that. The concern with the conflict of interest is if the department were to be the conduit for actual funds outside of 4E funds, there would be a potential conflict there. And that would be because, of course, the DHS oversees the child protection system, big picture, and that these children are potentially at some point wards of the state. In other words, they would be committed to the care of the Commissioner of Human Services, potentially creating a conflict of interest there. So in terms of the 4E assistance, we think that that is something that would be workable. We certainly want to assist in any way we can to make this happen.
Thank you, Ms. Bailey. Representative Rasmussen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is for Mr. Freeman. You know, Mr. Freeman, you talked about the potential cost of counties, both in terms of implementation and for funding the councils that would be required in this bill. I was wondering, Mr. Freeman, with your conversations with the counties, do you have any idea on where this money potentially would or could come from? You know, is this going to come from child protective services budgets that could be spent, on ensuring that children are safe, or is it going to go to property taxpayers in the counties or come out of the human services budget? If you could give some light on, you know, how this unfunded mandate is going to be met, that'd be greatly appreciated.
Mr. Freeman.
Madam Chair, Representative Rasmussen, thank you for the question. Currently, counties do cover the parental representation in instances in which the court indicates that's appropriate. And so they are paying a significant amount for those resources, I believe, by county. They're paid through the county administrator's office, and so it's funds administered by the county board, and those are property tax levy dollars. This bill would expand that to include all EPC hearings, and so we would expect that that cost would increase. And then the other impact to human services would be administering or processing the Title IV E dollars. We do know, again, not all will be eligible for the Title IV E dollars, and equally, there's paperwork, financial eligibility, and others that needs to be collected in order to be eligible to seek those dollars. We expect that human services will be a part of collecting that information, and so that will be administrative costs as well as administrative costs for managing administrative centrally through the county administrator. So I would expect it's county levy dollars that would be put towards the parental representation costs and then administrative costs to human services.
Thank you, Mr. Freeman. Representative Becker-Finn, any closing comments?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just want to note that as it stands right now, counties are carrying and have carried this obligation for over a decade. So really, this is an opportunity for us to move the ball. And, you know, at any point, because it is subjective, the courts could feel like appointing counsel in every single one of these hearings as it stands right now. And so, again, I just want to take it back to the overall, the goal here and the question before us is whether parents with lower incomes should be appointed an attorney when facing termination of their parental rights. And I think that question is ultimately what we're dealing with and why we're bringing this bill forward. I will also say that conversations will continue, and this is certainly, as I noted, a really difficult one because of the, you know, all the things that have been noted in the conversation here. So would really appreciate support and appreciate you hearing this bill, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Becker Finn, and thank you for working on these issues. It's really appreciated. So with that, members, House File 312 as amended will be laid over for possible inclusion. The next file we have bill for consideration is House File 1943. I'll move 1943 so it's in front of the committee. And House File 1943 will also be laid over for possible inclusion in our Human Services Finance Bill. Representative Pinto, please tell us about House File 1943.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair, and thanks for giving the bill a hearing. Members, House File 1943 relates to the interaction between the sex trafficking of young people and our child welfare system. Before 2014, our state's standard response to the sex trafficking of young people was actually to charge them with a crime, to direct them to the juvenile delinquency system. And that year in 2014, we finally fixed that by adopting the Safe Harbor Law, which directs them instead to the child welfare system, which makes great sense, except that that system in that system, child protection agencies are required to investigate the situation, which is good, but to interview the alleged offender, which typically is a parent or a caregiver, a teacher. That all makes sense. But when you have a non-caregiver sex trafficker, that can really cause a lot of problems. Both it can put the child more at risk. It can interfere with the law enforcement investigation of those situations. And I should note, members may be aware, but in my work outside the legislature, I work as a prosecutor and have specialized a lot in these cases and actually was the statewide director of training and protocol development for the Safe Harbor system. So a lot of familiarity with that. So this gets us to the bill. So more than 200 stakeholders got together and developed the response that's in this bill. It's the non-caregiving sex trafficking assessment. It removes the interview requirement for non-caregiver sex trafficking offenders. It directs have law enforcement do that investigation. And it provides for training and has sort of a separate track that goes in. You'll see a number of letters in support on the committee website. This will bring our state in full compliance with the Federal Justice for Victims of Trafficking Act. And the final note before I turn to the testifiers is to say that DHS actually worked with the stakeholders and advanced this previously. This was heard in HHS policy last term, just before the pandemic, I think March 13th. This is not a priority for the department this session. They're just prioritizing other things, but they've been real helpful. So I do have one testifier and then move to questions. And thank you so much, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Pinto. The first testifier I have is Kyla Marie Granda. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and affiliation and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Chair, committee members. My name is Kyla Marie Granda, and I'm with Unspoken Voices. I am testifying this morning on behalf of this in support of it. My education, I hold a bachelor, a double bachelor's in counseling and pastoral ministries. I have my LADC licensure, and I have a master's in criminal justice, specializing in fields such as this, prevention, intervention, rehabilitation. I also am about two-thirds of the way towards my PhD, and I'm specializing in human trafficking and that intersectionality. So I want to bring not only my professional experience, my educational experience, but my professional as an advocate as well. I've worked in the fields of advocacy since I was about 18, so it's been a couple of decades. But I've also been in the system. I was in the system as a youth, and I was trafficked. And I was trafficked by both, I would say, more non-familial family members. And in my case, there was not enough. Integrity. There was not enough investigation. There was not enough done. And in the cases of so many children that I see that I currently work with, even last year, you know, in shuffling and trying to do the different pieces with Safe Harbor and all of the reform we've done, it's been amazing, but there's been some gaps, and this is a gap area. And so just very quickly, you know, looking even from my own experience, and then bringing in the story of a young girl I worked with last year who was 14 and she was being trafficked in a rural community in West Central Minnesota, and trafficked through, and being trafficked, you know, back down south and by a non-familial family member. And the county had no idea what to do. Law enforcement had no idea what to do. It turned into this perpetual cycle. And then finally they just said, well, we don't have enough and hands off, and nothing was done, and that little girl and that trafficker left. And so nothing was done, and that's why things like this need to happen, because we need that law enforcement piece. We need the safety, and that's what that gives victims, survivors in this case, is it gives them a chance for safety for themselves and for their families. So that's why I'm in support of this. Yeah, so thank you so much for listening to me.
Thank you, Ms. Granda, for sharing your experience, and thank you for your advocacy and working in this area. So for questions, we have Katie Erickson from Hennepin County Child Protections and Sarah Ladd from DHS. So are there any questions for the bill author, the testifier, or our experts? Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Pinto, thank you for bringing this bill forward. I appreciate the effort that you and the task force have put into this. Just a simple question in terms of, you know, naturally we want to be investigating those that are perpetrating such an awful effort against these kids. But in most cases, my sense would be that the family members, the parents, might be also aware, if not just solely implicitly. So, in instances where that is possible, are we excluding them from the investigation, or do they continue, or would they continue to be assessed in addition to the non-caregiver sex trafficker?
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think I would direct that to Ms. Ladd or Ms. Erickson. I'm not sure which of them, maybe one of them. I see Ms. Ladd unmuting, so she may be able to help.
Sure. Ms. Ladd, please introduce yourself. And
good morning, Madam Chair and representatives of the committee. My name is Sarah Ladd. I am the Human Trafficking Child Protection Coordinator at the Department of Human Services in the Child Safety and Permanency Division. And thank you so much for the question. My response to that would be that if the parents and caregivers of the child victim are aware or involved in the sex trafficking of the child, that there would still be a requirement to do an investigation if they are part of the offense itself. So they would be considered alleged offenders. The creation of this new response would not in any way detract from the ability to hold parents and caregivers accountable if they are alleged offenders in trafficking situations. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Ladd. Any other questions from members? Seeing none, Representative Pinto, any closing comments?
Again, thank you so much, Madam Chair, for accommodating this. And members, really, I would urge your support. I'll just note that there is a fiscal note that is still being finalized, but we expect the cost to be around $140,000 in the first fiscal year, and then a much lesser cost going forward. But I know we'll be looking at that. Thank you again for your support.
Thank you, Representative Pinto. So House File 1943 will be laid over for possible inclusion in our Human Services Finance Bill. The next bill for consideration is House File 2084. I'll move House File 2084, so it's before the committee, and it will be laid over for possible inclusion. Representative Jordan, welcome to the committee. Is she here? I don't see Representative Jordan. Is she here, Ms. Hansen?
No.
No, she's not here yet. So let's move on to House File 2011. And we will come back to House File 2084. So we will I'll move to table that. House File 2011. Let's see. First, we need to move the division report for House File 2011. Chair Fisher, would you like to make the motion?
Yes, Madam Chair. I'd like to move the Behavioral Division report on House File 2011, please.
Okay, so Chair Fisher moves to adopt the division report from Behavioral Health. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? The motion prevails and the division report is adopted. So House File 2011, I'll move so it's before the committee now since we adopted the committee, the division report. Representative Katiza Watoon, welcome to the committee. Are you here? I'm not seeing Representative Katiza Watoon.
Looks like she's here.
She is here.
Oh, good. Representative Katiza Watoon, your bill is before us. You are muted. Not tabled.
Chair Schultz,
okay.
Representative Jordan just entered. I'd like to go back.
Okay, we're going to go back, and you can just ignore my motion to table because that requires a voice vote. So we can take bills in any order. So we'll go back to House File 2084. Sorry, everyone. So I'll move 2084 so it's before the committee. It will be laid over for possible inclusion. Representative Jordan, to your bill, House File 2084.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and good morning, members. Thank you so much for your consideration of House File 2084, which provides funding for recovery community organizations in Minnesota, or RCOs. RCOs are community-based nonprofits that provide free, non-clinical recovery support services for anyone who needs help at any point in their recovery journey. This could include things like one-to-one coaching from peer recovery specialists, linked to resources to support an individual's recovery journey, such as housing, employment, healthcare, et cetera, and also a recovery-friendly environment to focus on their health. One point, Madam Chair and members, I think is especially important for you to understand is that RCOs are part of the continuum of care for people with substance abuse disorder. Recovery differs from treatment. So treatment is like the surgery for a torn ACL, and treatment is the physical therapy and primary care someone may work on for in an extended period of time. RCOs are culturally specific, and they fill in the gaps people need before, during, and after treatment. So this is a bill to address a lack of investment by the state to support recovery. The funding in this bill is necessary as most of the services RCOs provide do not qualify as billable expenses. Minnesota lags behind other states, including Georgia, Vermont, and Massachusetts, in recognizing the necessity of RCOs and providing funding similar to the bill here. Like many Minnesotans, I have family members, friends, and people I love on that same continuum of their recovery. All of their recovery journeys have been unique, and some of them have been in treatment programs, and all of them are good people who deserve to live their lives with dignity and respect. My loved ones, like all people, need services to manage their health like any other condition. It's not easy, and like so many Minnesotans, they can't do it alone. So here to talk more about what RCOs do, I'd like to turn it over to Major John Donovan to talk about his work serving the St. Cloud area. And I also have Wendy Jones, the Executive Director of the Minnesota Recovery Connection, to answer technical questions members may have.
Thank you, Representative Jordan. And the appropriation is $2 million in each year of the biennium. So welcome, Major John Donovan, to the committee. Please state your name and affiliation for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I am Major John Donovan, the director of the Recovery Community Organization, the Recovery Community Network in Central Minnesota. I have a brief statement that I would like to read. Again, thank you, Madam Chair, and good morning, esteemed members of this committee of the Minnesota House of Representatives. I am Major John Donovan, a veteran of two combat tours in Iraq and a nine-month peacekeeping mission with the Minnesota National Guard to Bosnia-Herzegovina during Governor Pawlenty's administration. I retired from the Minnesota National Guard in March of 2018. My undergraduate degree is from St. Cloud State University, go Huskies, and my graduate degree is from Boston University. But of all the aforementioned items, the thing that I am most proud of is I am a person in long-term recovery. It's been over 42 years since I've had a drink. No matter who you are, war changes a person. Whether you served as a cook or in combat, whether you served in the infirmary or in the infantry, the experiences of being in war fundamentally change a person. You are never the same. For some, the change is hardly noticeable, but it is there. Still others have troubles readjusting to civilian life, and those changes manifest themselves in divorce, depression, drug abuse, suicide. At the Recovery Community Network in Central Minnesota, we are providing peer services to our veterans, service members, and their families. The VA in St. Cloud is great, but it still requires someone to go to them. We go to the veteran. Allow me to illustrate. Tony, a combat veteran, received a scholarship from us to attend a Recovery Coach Academy in June of 2019. This workshop provides an attendee with the skill set to become a certified peer recovery specialist. Prior to the training, Tony was staying at the Eagles Healing Nest in Sauk Center. He was unemployed, struggling with recovery, and trying to find his place in the world post his combat experiences. This is what Tony said. This training completely changed my life. Today, I am a recovery coach for Sobriety First Treatment Center, and I get to pay it forward every day. Thank you, Minnesota Recovery Connection, and thank you, Recovery Community Network, for this amazing opportunity. Ladies and gentlemen, the work we are doing is making a difference and is serving those who served us. Investing in RCO infrastructure improves outcomes for all systems of care. We are here to compete with treatment providers. We're here to complete what they've started. Thank you for your time and attention, and may God bless all of you for the honorable work that you are doing on behalf of the great citizens of this great state of Minnesota.
Thank you, Major Donovan. Looks like we have a question. I think it's Representative Novotny.
Thank you, Chair. Question for the author. How many of these individual grants are handed out, and what's the application process?
Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Representative Schultz. I think that would be a good question for Wendy Jones to answer.
Thank you. Ms. Jones, please state your name and affiliation and proceed to answer the question.
Thank you, Madam.
To the committee.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Wendy Jones. I'm the Executive Director of Minnesota Recovery Connection. I'm also a person in long-term recovery from substance use disorder. The question is about how many grants there currently are. This is a different grant process, and there's currently a small appropriation that is dedicated towards the funding of training of peer recovery specialists that's in, handled by the Department of Human Services. There are only three communities currently eligible for that. Those are in Moorhead, the Twin Cities, and Rochester. Right now, there are three grants that have been administered through that, one of which, the grant to Minnesota Recovery Connection, we have included the Recovery Community Network and Recovery Alliance Duluth in our grant because they were not eligible to apply for various reasons in the existing statute. This is a new statute that is designed to focus on infrastructure for recovery community organizations, which provide a wide range of services, most of which are not billable. The current legislation really focuses on the peer recovery specialist workforce and training peer recovery specialists. The RCOs, again, Minnesota lacks in recovery community organizations around the state. There are none in all of Western Minnesota. This funding would enable stabilization of the existing recovery community organizations and enable growth of new recovery community organizations in areas that are not currently being served by a recovery community organization.
Thank you, Ms. Jones. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Jordan, is there a companion for this in the Senate that's traveling currently?
Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Albright. There is not currently one introduced, but we've been working with March to work on Senate paths forward.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is whether there is evidence of efficacy for this. I know there's a lot of work being done in the area of SUD to think about which approaches work better than other approaches. Is there any data in this area?
Representative Dorden or Ms. Jones?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Liebling. I'll take that question. Yes, there is an incredible amount of mounting evidence, particularly nationally, about the efficacy of or the efficiency of peer recovery support services. The Recovery Research Institute, based out of Harvard, recently published two long-term studies about recovery community organizations and determined that they significantly increase recovery outcomes for individuals from a broad spectrum. There's significant research about peer recovery specialists when working within community systems. Minnesota Recovery Connection, for example, has been working with St. Joseph's Hospital through MHealth Fairview, working with people who are coming out of a crisis situation. Those individuals who engaged with our peer recovery specialists have shown a 76% reduction in emergency department visits and a 71% reduction in hospitalizations, 90% reduction in visits that are related to substance use disorder. And this is a statistic that's on par with the use of peer recovery specialists in other systems around the country. Other studies show comparable statistics of a 71 to 80% reduction in hospitalizations. And that's just one example of where peer recovery specialists are used. And peer recovery specialists connected to a recovery community organization stay with the individual when they leave the system, which is why RCOs are so critical. We're the filler in between the systems, and we stay with the person, not with the system. So someone may be working with a peer recovery specialist while they're incarcerated. They might leave that system. The peer recovery specialist stays with them and works with them as they navigate to other elements of the system, whether that might be employment or a drug court. So there is a lot of evidence through Harvard research, through individual states. Minnesota is lacking in its own research, and that is something that I would hope that the state would consider in the future. But there is certainly significant evidence that recovery community organizations and peer recovery support services, when they're connected to RCOs, significantly reduce costs and improve efficiency in treatment and entering treatment and sustaining recovery.
Thank you, Ms. Jones. Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Dorden. I am new to this area of statute, so I was actually just looking up this section in 254B about what a recovery community organization is. And I just wondered if you could just explain for me, as a person new to this, how does this interact with faith-based groups that do celebrate recovery, or the 12-step programs and those sort of groups? What if any interaction do they have? Thank you.
Ms. Jones?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Robbins. That's a great question. Recovery community organizations differ in a few ways. One is that we honor all pathways. So recovery community organizations are grounded in the principles of there are multiple pathways to recovery, and we're not going to tell you which one is the right one for you. We're going to work with you to help you find that. And so it's not exclusive of 12-step programs or faith-based programs. I like to think of recovery community organizations as sort of like department stores, where there are a lot of options. And we have really helpful, trained peer recovery specialists who help you navigate all the options and support you as you try different things on and try to figure out, okay, this is going to work for me. Often people have, when they're coming out of a particular treatment program, they've burned a lot of bridges in their community, and they may not be able to go back to their faith. They may not be able to go back to a particular community of support that they had in the past. Recovery community organizations also serve that function as being sort of a neutral place where the participants there, the staff there, the volunteers there will help people navigate new systems of recovery and new support systems. Again, honoring all pathways, meeting people where they're at, and not doing for people, but doing with people. So think of RCOs as being a place for really helpful guides that have been professionally trained in motivational interviewing. They've been trained in recovery resource navigation, ethics and boundaries. And so that's also what differs them from, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous or another community-based 12-step program, is that the facilitators at recovery community organizations have a certification and a professional training that goes along with that to help people navigate systems and to honor all pathways. So a neutral department store, lots of options, helpful guides that can help you pick the right thing.
Thank you, Ms. Jones, and thank you, Representative Robbins. I have one question before we go back to the bill author. Do the specialists become sponsors in the 12-step program or AA, or do they work with sponsors?
Thank you, Madam Chair. That is completely up to the participant. Peer recovery specialists are not sponsors. Sponsors are affiliated with a 12-step program, and the goal of a sponsor is to help you work the steps. A peer recovery specialist's goal is to help you set your recovery goals and help you meet those. And that may include working a 12-step program. So a peer recovery specialist may be helpful in getting you connected with a sponsor, but it's not the responsibility of a peer recovery specialist to be the sponsor. And that, again, aligns with this philosophy of all pathways and helping someone find what works for them. 12-step programs work well for some people, but not for everyone. And so, again, it comes back to being that trained, neutral professional provider that has that lived experience of substance use disorder and recovery themselves, who can help connect you with a variety of options.
Thank you, Ms. Jones. Any closing comments, Representative Jordan?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. One point, I received some notification to Representative Albright's question that Senator Utke included this language in Senate File 1768. So there is a path in the Senate. The Senate is interested in this. This has bipartisan support, both here in the House and in the Senate. This is something that's critically important, and it does really fill in gaps of care that we currently have existing in Minnesota. So I thank the committee for your time today and really cannot ask you enough for your support. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Jordan. And I do believe that was heard in Senator Abler's committee. I think I recall having listened to a hearing with it being discussed. Okay, with that, members, House File 2084 will be laid over for possible inclusion in our Human Services Finance Bill. Thank you, Representative Jordan, and thank you, testifiers. So the next item will go back to House File 2011. We adopted the division report from Behavioral Health, so I'll move House File 2011 so it's before us. Representative Kutiza Watun, are you with us now?
I am, Madam Chair. Thank you. I was dealing with a bus pickup.
I can understand. Welcome to our committee. Please present House File 2011.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair and members. Today, I would like to give you a little bit of background on House File 2011, the Youth Act. For many children and youth, there are options to access community-based mental health services, especially school-linked mental health services that can meet their needs. But some youth will require more intensive mental health services. And unfortunately, there's very few resources for these youth and their families to access intensive mental health services in their communities. Last session, the legislature did pass some policy changes to the Youth Act program, but we still have work that we need to do. So House File 2011 focuses on one successful program to provide these supports in the community. Intensive Non-Residential Rehabilitative Mental Health Services, or Youth Act, provides a multidisciplinary and team-based approach that's modeled off of Assertive Community Treatment, or ACT, teams for the adult population. While eligibility criteria are different for Youth Act, both provide intensive supports in the community for children and youth with serious mental illnesses. The Youth Act team coordinates treatment for mental illness, school and employment, housing, family engagement, and physical health services. Currently, Guild Incorporated and Northern Pines Mental Health Center offer Youth Act services. While we do still have more work that needs to be done and to improve and sustain Youth Act, House File 2011 gets things started by allowing younger children and older youth to be eligible. This will increase much needed access for intensive mental health services for these children, while allowing older youth to remain on Youth Act if the service is still beneficial to them and they're not yet eligible for an adult ACT team. So
high points, this bill expands eligibility for Youth Act services for children as young as 8 years old and as old as 25 years old. One Youth Act team can treat children between the ages of 8 and 16 or 14 to 25, and these teams must have specialized training for the age ranges that they serve. And in Section 4, we have a technical fix to stipulate that the treatment team must complete an individual treatment plan for each client. With that, Madam Chair, I do have two testifiers with me today, and I would like to have them share their testimony. Sure.
Thank you, Representative Cotiza-Watoon. The first testifier I have is Addison Moore. Welcome to the committee. Please proceed with your testimony.
Hi, I'm Addison. Dear representatives, I'm speaking to you today to share my story and express my support for expanding Youth Act team services to those 8 to 25. By authorizing this expansion, you have the ability to save lives, lives that are real people that will make real change in this world. I started on the EQ Youth Act team in February of 2014. I was their second client and honestly, at times, probably one of their most difficult. There was one time that I was in the middle of a family therapy session with the ACT team therapist there, where I had already been suicidal, and I decided that I was finished. I decided to run away barefoot in an attempt to end my life. The ACT team still continued to stick with me and didn't discharge me as all previous programs had or would have. They were a lifeline that when I had no one else, and they were a lifeline when I had no one else, and not just for me, but my entire family. They held on to the hope for my future that I didn't have, and honestly, I wasn't sure I ever would have. Prior to the EQ ACT team, my mom was told that I was the lost cause. I would never have a job, never go to college, never live on my own, never drive a car, never contribute to society in any meaningful way. She was essentially told that I would be a burden to this world living in a group home for the rest of my life. It is because of the faith that EQ had in me that I learned that I could prove each and every one of those providers, police officers, paramedics, and educational professionals wrong. I do live in my own apartment with my dogs, Zaggy and Charlie. I got my driver's license in July of last year and have already driven over 40,000 miles. I really like to take road trips. I have spoken to high schools, colleges, police departments, and many other organizations throughout Minnesota and the nation with NAMI's public education program sharing my story, and I now sit on the Minnesota State Subcommittee on Children's Mental Health. I would say that I am far from a burden to this society, and I have a lot to offer this world. Expanding access to the Youth Act Team program would allow others, like myself, who have been deemed lost causes, not to just survive, but to thrive, to do great things in this world. This expansion can make it so that people who need more support than can be offered through other services have the ability to avoid residential treatment centers and more restrictive environments and continue to live their lives in the community where everybody deserves to belong. Mental illness can start before the age of 16. In fact, for my older sister, her first psychiatric admission was at 9 years old. My younger sister's was at 7. Maybe had my older sister had access to Youth Act services, she would still be here today, but instead she ended her life to suicide at 18 years old. I remember during my time on the EQ team, my 21st birthday came up in discussions often. It was a day that I dreaded as I didn't know if I would be better by then. I didn't know what I would do after my 21st birthday if I still needed that level of support as I have a dissociative disorder, not a psychotic disorder. I didn't know if I would have enough support after my 21st birthday to keep myself alive. Had I known that I had 4 more years of time on the EQ team, I would have had a lot less sleepless nights and endless worries about if I had enough skills to stay alive. I'm lucky that I did have those skills and I'm doing so well now, both personally and professionally, but things could have been much different. I strongly urge you to approve this expansion of services for the Youth Act team to those 8 to 25, as you have the ability to save not just lives, but also futures. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Moore, for sharing your story with us this morning, and you're already doing great things, so thank you. So the next testifier I have may be just available for questions. Sam Smith from NAMI, are you testifying or just available for questions?
Madam Chair, I'm just available for questions if they come up. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. Any questions from members for the bill author or testifier? Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Cotiza-Watoon, thank you for bringing this bill forward. And to Ms. Moore, thank you for your testimony, and your life matters. And so thank you for being courageous and moving forward. Representative Cotiza-Watoon, I note that the age span is quite disparate in terms of just the both mental as well as emotional and physical growth of individuals. And it is a non-residential rehabilitative service, but I'm sure that they're going to central locations for the counseling. Are they in the same proximity to, say, an 8-year-old to a 26-year-old? What safety precautions are being afforded to these individuals, particularly in the precarious state that they might be, and being vulnerable to others that might also be in precarious states as well? How do we make sure that their safety is of the utmost concern?
Representative Cotiza Watoon, would you like to answer that, or should I have Mr. Smith answer
that? That's a great question. Thank you, Madam Chair. I think I will let Mr. Smith answer that.
Mr. Smith.
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, thank you for the question. One important protection, because it is a broad age range, is that teams would be serving youth between the ages of 8 to 16 or 14 to 25, but it still is a larger gap, and it's important to remember that this is a team-based service that can be provided in the home or in the community in a lot of different settings. And we approached the Youth Act providers about the age ranges here, and they thought that they made sense, and so we did think it was going to work out okay. But I hope that answers your question.
Can I add as well?
Ms. Moore.
I want to add as well, when I was on the Youth Act team, as well as I still stay in contact with some of the team, they do all of their services either in school or at home. It is almost never happens where anybody goes in to do services. That is one of the big benefits of the ACT team, is that the services are received in the community, not in a treatment program or at the office.
Thank you, Ms. Moore. Any other questions from members? Seeing none, Representative Cotiza Watoon, closing comments.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think, with Ms. Moore sharing her testimony, we can just see how needed this type of expansion of this program is. And I appreciate Ms. Moore's sharing her story and for the support of members, so that we can make sure that all of our children and youth get the services that they need to maybe get back on track and continue living their lives.
Thank you. I don't have a fiscal note for this. Is that correct, Representative Cotiza Watoon?
No, that's correct.
Okay, so we'll wait on the fiscal note. So we appreciate you bringing this bill forward, and we appreciate all the work that was done on Chair Fisher's committee with the bill. And thank you to our testifiers for being with us today. So with that, members, House File 2011 will be laid over for possible inclusion in our Human Services Finance Bill. Okay, next for consideration is House File 1929. This bill will be laid over for possible inclusion. So let's see. Right, Vice Chair Bonner, would you like to move House File 1929 so it's before our committee and your amendment?
Yes, Madam Chair. I would like to move House File 1929. And I do have the A2 amendment, which makes minor technical clarity changes and helps us to align with the work of Chair Nelson in the Senate.
Okay, so Vice Chair Bonner moves the A2 amendment for House File 1929. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Aye. Aye. Any aye. Opposed? Okay, the motion prevails and the A2 amendment is adopted. Vice Chair Bonner, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. There's nothing harder than watching someone you love struggle, barely recognizing the person you know and love, wondering if the essence of who they are remains beneath the surface, to feel as if they're slipping through your fingers. Psychosis is a disabling condition that disrupts thoughts and reality, making reality seem fluid and hard to grasp. You may hear or see things that others don't, leading to anxiety and apprehension, pulling away of family and friends, while surfing a wave of emotions from extreme highs to the desolation of no feeling at all. Psychosis can be triggered by conditions like schizophrenia, one of the most debilitating conditions in the world. 3 out of 100 people will experience it in their lifetime. Early psychosis or first episode psychosis is frightening for those who live it and painful for the families who watch or to comprehend. Often starting in early adulthood, we don't know how to prevent these conditions. but we know psychosis is a first warning sign. Groundbreaking research shows that early intervention can dramatically alter the trajectory of the lives of those who experience it. For this reason, states are mandated to dedicate 10% of their federal behavioral health block grant to first episode programs. And need is real. The current programs are overflowing, and the wait list of 4 months is the longest since the program's inception. The bill invests in programs proven to provide better improvements in symptoms, relationships, quality of life, greater engagement in work or school. We know that early intervention equals better outcomes. The bill expands these more holistic practices that include family and recovery to include bipolar and extreme depression, and seeks to expand it to meet the needs across the state. I bring the bill today as someone who knows the helpless feeling of watching someone I love deeply feel as if they're slipping away. This bill does more than fill a line on an item on a budget. It provides hope for patients and for families who desperately need it. And with that, I do have a summary of the program in your packets available for you. And with that, I do have one testifier, Ms. Howe, and I have Sam from Smith from NAMI here to answer additional questions.
Thank you, Vice Chair Bonners. The first testifier, Nancy Howe. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and affiliation and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, and thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Nancy Howe, and I'm the parent of a young adult who has struggled with a severe mental illness for over 16 years. I'm testifying in support of House File 1929 regarding continued funding for first episode psychosis programs. My 31-year-old son was diagnosed with schizophrenia as a junior in high school. Before he became ill, he played the violin, was in drama and debate, played football, loved to snowboard, and was well-liked among his peers. Sadly, life for our family changed forever on September 23rd, 2006, when he experienced his first episode of psychosis. After being hospitalized, my son didn't have access to adequate services, which would have aided in his recovery at that time. With the isolation that comes from having no work or purpose in his days, the voices often return. He recently described the anguish of living with dulled emotions, impaired memory, and the inability to think clearly as living in a prison in his own mind. Since that initial episode, he has been hospitalized 13 times, has been in 2 90-day residential treatment programs, and is currently under civil commitment to take his medication. Sadly, with each hospitalization, his cognitive functioning has decreased and he has become more mentally disabled. Because of this disability, he hasn't attended college, is unable to work, he's no longer able to live on his own, and has been living in an adult foster care group home for the past 2 years. A truly tragic situation, considering that at one time he had an IQ of 124, a bright, creative mind with hopes for a wife, children, and fulfilling career. There is significant research that demonstrates that the earlier a first episode of psychosis is identified and treated, the better the long-term prognosis becomes. This support is accomplished through a coordinated specialty care model called Navigate, a team of mental health professionals who offer wraparound services for those who've experienced a first episode of psychosis. For the past 2 years, I have served on our local Navigate teams as a family peer support specialist, and I've witnessed firsthand the success individuals experience when they do receive proper medication, individual resiliency therapy, and are able to get back to work and get back to school. I've witnessed families thrive due to the opportunity for family education and support and access to resources through NAMI Minnesota. Having adequate funding in place for these programs is critical. Offering treatment and support for the patient and family from the onset of the illness is essential to the individual's ability to develop into a contributing member of our community. So please join me in advocating for these necessary services so that others experiencing the disabling symptoms of psychosis will have the opportunity for healing and wholeness. Thank you for your time and consideration today.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Howe. Any questions from members? Representative Mohler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't have a question. I just want to thank Ms. Howe for her testimony and Representative Bonner for bringing this bill. And just also, this is just such an important issue, and I'm so glad that you're bringing it to light. I had the opportunity to read former Representative Mindy Greiling's book, Fix What You Can, and it does an even deeper dive into all of this. And I just would really encourage other members of this committee to take a look at that book if they have the chance. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Representative Mohler. I also read that book before session. I definitely second that recommendation. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Bonner. I note that existing law already allows grant funding for interventions for both first episodes of psychosis. Kind of a two-part question. How much funding do you foresee using on these grants, because I see there's an open appropriation for both fiscal year 22 and fiscal year 23 for both psychotic episodes as well as first episode of mood disorders. And then just to follow on to that, in the past, what funding level has been utilized and what have been the outcomes from those grants?
Vice Chair Bonner.
Thank you. It should be noted, and I'll let Sam kind of chip in here and make sure that he keeps me honest. Much of the funding for these programs is actually covered by medical coverage, but the program itself, there is some cost to administering it. Currently, the regular program is, I believe, about $350,000, and Sam, you can correct me, per year. There will likely be about a $351 one-time setup cost to expand this to include the mood disorders, which is bipolar and extreme bouts of depression. And then they expect that the program would have a similar cost per year. And Sam from NAMI is here if you want to chime in and make sure that I've accurately reflected that.
Mr. Smith?
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, Representative Bonner is correct that is the kind of approximate cost of adding a new program. I would note that there are currently four providers, three in the metro and one in Duluth, and we do think there is a significant need across Greater Minnesota for this service. And as Representative Bonner mentioned, many or most of the services provided by first episode programs can bill medical assistance, other insurance plans, but that there are some portions of the service that aren't billable, including employment and education supports, which we think are extremely important so that we are allowing these young people with psychosis to continue taking steps forward in their career and educational goals.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. Other questions from members? Not seeing any. Chair Liebling?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And first of all, thank you to the testifier for discussing this, and it certainly is an important issue. And I was lucky enough to serve with Representative Greiling and got to know her quite well, and haven't been able to read her book, however, but I hope to do that. But the question is, we have, I think, over the years been trying at least to build a mental health system, and now we have the CCBHHs, if I have the acronym right, the Community Behavioral Health Wraparound Service Centers. And I'm just wondering if there's an interaction with this, because, you know, the system is different than it was when Representative Greiling was serving. And I know this particular issue was one of great concern to her. And I just wonder if, you know, where we've moved since that time, if we have.
Mr. Smith, I believe Chair Liebling is referring to CABHS.
Yes. Thank you, Madam.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Liebling. Thank you for the question. So the CABS program is a state-operated treatment program in the Willmar area, and which provides really important support for young people with very high needs. And I think our hope would be that by having, you know, earlier referral and treatment, that we could be making an intervention before any kind of placement in state-operated services would become necessary. And so I think that's more than anything, I think, what is so promising and exciting about continued investments in first episode psychosis programs.
And Mr. Smith, how many beds are at the Wilmer? Is it 16? Or...
Madam Chair, I would defer to the department on that. I don't have that information off the
top of my Madam head. Chair?
Chair Liebling?
I'm sorry, that really wasn't what I was asking. It was about the community behavioral health centers.
Mr. Smith?
Madam Chair, Representative Liebling, yeah, I thought you might be referring to certified community behavioral health clinics, or CCBHCs, which is an extremely promising model that's thankfully no longer a pilot project here in Minnesota that really is connecting people with services earlier. And I think there's a really strong synergy between the CCBHC model and first episode, where what's most exciting about CCBHCs is the ease with which people kind of can begin accessing services and supports, and could potentially make a referral to a first episode program, which is going to be providing a more kind of intensive and focused support for people with that first episode of psychosis. But a really, I think, promising direction.
Thank you. Too many acronyms, Chair Liebling. And they're very close. Representative Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, having carried that bill when we did the clinics, I just wanted to point out that I know there's one based in northwestern Minnesota that's probably, well, one of the pilot projects that has existed and very successful. I do not know if they're dealing with the day treatments. I assume that because they're doing quite a bit of successful programming and heard great things. But Chair Liebling, I too have the problem with that acronym, even though I carried the bill. So it's just a mouthful. But that has been a real successful program, and I hope we can use more of that to address those immediate issues, because that was the intent of that program, was to deal with the right of ways. I need help. There's something wrong, to be able to help families. And certainly I would encourage people, because I have a really good friend that is very successful, but had a lot of bipolar problems. And it just is really helps us to live life and be successful in more than just, that medical issue. It's kind of like having all kinds of other health problems that are long-term. You have to deal with them so that you can move on. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Keel, for working on that legislation. We appreciate it. Vice Chair Bonner, any closing comments?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Really, this bill is about giving people a good start and making sure that we can change that trajectory. And by early intervention. And I know that so many families in this situation feel helpless. And the ability to have a program that really has a more holistic approach, where family can be involved and really take an active role in being able to change that trajectory, is something that's really important. And so I thank you all, and I urge your support.
Thank you, Vice Chair Bonner. With that, House File 1929, as amended, will be laid over for possible inclusion in the Human Services Finance Bill. The last item before we go to recess is House File 2116. Representative Frederick, would you like to move the division report from Behavioral Health?
I move, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Frederick moves the division report from Behavioral Health. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Motion prevails and the division report is adopted. So House File 2116 will be laid over for possible inclusion in our Human Services Finance Report. I'll move it so it's in front of our committee. Representative Frederick to House File 2116. And I don't see any amendments.
No, Madam Chair. Thank you, Madam Chair. House File 2116 is a paperwork reduction bill. We have heard in this committee, we've heard in behavioral health, the need for providers in mental health, in the substance use disorder world, all across the state, in lots of different ways. And what this bill does is it takes a look at that need from a slightly different angle. And what it does is it looks at the current providers that we have in the substance use disorder world, and it is trying to address how can we get them more FaceTime to the people that, or virtual FaceTime, to the people that they're serving. And so it's a way or an attempt anyways to increase efficiency so we can continue providing more services because we all know that the citizens across the state need them. And at this point, I would turn it over to my testifier to go into more detail.
Thank you, Representative Frederick. We have Lance Egli. Please introduce yourself and your affiliation and then proceed.
Yes, Honorable Committee Chair Schultz and members of the committee, my name is Lance Egli, testifying for the March Professional Association. March has previously testified before the Behavioral Health Policy Division of this committee that House File 2116 formalizes a collaborative relationship between Department of Human Services and substance use disorder providers to reduce paperwork, improve systems, and make regulation more consistent. This bill improves the capacity to achieve these goals and cements together the voluntary and legislative efforts. In the Behavioral Health Policy Division, amendments were made that are needed some further understanding. Representative Frederick was helpful in bringing March and DHS together to further our understanding of each other. We reached agreement in each area of the amendment. Regarding the change of the word test to assess, March meant to include whatever word is used, actively observational, short-term mini experiments, like computer alpha testing, just to see if things would work out, in addition to listening and analysis. In the discussions, we realized that DHS does not yet have the same understanding of what these are as does March. So we have decided to pursue this better understanding through our voluntary efforts and not in the wording of legislation. We do want the legislature to understand that with either word, March never meant a complete evaluation of all the changes we will recommend, only selective exploration. Regarding the option to relax qualifications of the vendor, DHS indicated that they would first be required to put out an RFP under the original criteria. March is confident that a qualified vendor will apply, and so we are not concerned about the option being needed if that fails. We've submitted an exhibit showing that this has been accomplished in other states and how much has been accomplished effectively using a properly experienced vendor as a guide. We now understand that the amendment continues to dedicate $200,000 for the first year to the vendor and adds dedication of the $118,000 in the second year to the vendor. For this, March is thankful to both DHS and Representative Frederick. Thank you, Chairman Schultz, Representative Frederick, members of the House Human Services Policy and Finance Committee for your time. We hope you will approve this amended bill.
Thank you, Mr. Egli. And I have the fiscal note from this morning, I believe it came in. It's $159,000 for 2022 and $136,000 for 2023. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative, excuse me just a second, Frederick. When you talk about the consolidation of this to improve the overall process itself, you're going to contract with a vendor. Two questions. Is this a competitive bid program? And if so, what process will that follow? If not, and you are unilaterally deciding on a vendor, would you declare who that is?
Representative Frederick.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Albright. From my understanding, and I think DHS is here to provide some clarification for that, I think it would be a competitive bid program or application. And if they were unable to find someone through that process, then they could have the option to find someone more specifically in a targeted way. But I would welcome any comments DHS would have on that topic.
Thank you. Do we have someone from DHS that could help answer that question about the competitive bidding process and vendor selection? Ms. Grom? We cannot hear you, Ms. Grom.
Apologies. Christy Grom with the Department of Human Services.
Yes, this will be a competitive RFP that we would issue. And if there are more details that members want on that process, we do have Ms. Singh who's available to answer more questions on that.
Thank you, Ms. Graham. Representative Albright.
I'm wondering if Representative Frederick would expand on, we've heard numerous bills that also talk about the uniformity of the mental health services. I'm wondering if he could or would be willing to discuss how the intersection of those uniformity measures would intersect with what he proposes in this bill.
Representative Frederick, you want Ms. Ground to take that question?
So I think that, thank you, Madam Chair. I'll defer to DHS in just a second. I would say that it's not two separate issues. I would say that they can work hand in hand together. I think that the process of like the uniform services standard, if that's what Representative Albright is kind of referring to, I would say that works. It can work in parallel with this. And I think that we should always be trying to strive for efficiencies wherever possible. That I would, again, welcome any comments from DHS.
Ms. Graham?
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, so the Mental Health Uniform Services and Standards Phase 1 is moving through the legislative process this session, but subsequent to this session, there will be more work that we'll need to do work around substance use disorder services is something that we're looking to incorporate in the future. And then, again, I have Ms. Singh who can answer more detailed questions about some of those, the interactions on a more specific level.
Mr. Egley would like to contribute, I believe. Go ahead.
Sure. In the voluntary effort, we are integrating the paperwork reduction and the uniform service standard work. So we're doing our very best to make them work together.
Thank you. Ms. Singh?
Madam Chair, members, this is Neeja Singh. I am the Clinical Behavioral Health Director for Community Supports Administration, and I agree with what Dr. Egley and Representative Fredrickson said, that this is going to be an effort which will be using the same framework that U.S. Uniform Service Standards has developed, primarily for mental health, and of course, there will be like unique features that the world of SUD, substance use treatment, brings in. So all those like factors will be kept in consideration, but we will not reinvent the wheel because USS has done a lot of work on that. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Singh. Representative Keel, your hand is up. Did you have a question?
No, ma'am. Sorry. Take it down.
Any other questions from members? Seeing none, Representative Frederick, closing comments on your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would appreciate all the support from the members. It's just an effort to try to get more services available, or more time, I guess, available to the communities throughout the state. So that's at the core of what this bill is about, and I would appreciate the support. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Frederick, and thank you, Mr. Egley, for your testimony today. With that, House File 2116 will be laid over for possible inclusion in our Human Services Finance Bill. Members, thank you so much for asking very succinct questions. Thank you for your time this morning. We will recess until 10:30, come back, take up two bills on background studies from Representative Edelson, and then begin our overview and discussion and testimony with the governor's budget and supplemental budget. So thank you, members. We are in recess. Okay, welcome back, members. I'm going to reconvene Human Services, Finance, and Policy. So we're going to come back to order. So the first item on this part of the agenda is House File 1825. House File 1825, I'll move it so it's before the committee and it will be laid over for possible inclusion in our Human Services Finance Bill. Welcome, Representative Edelson, to the committee. Looks like you have a DE1 amendment.
I do, Madam Chair, and I would like to move the DE1 amendment.
I'll move the DE1 amendment to get the bill in the shape before your presentation. So, members, all those in favor of the DE1 amendment, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? Okay, the DE1 amendment, the motion prevails and the DE1 amendment is adopted. Representative Edelson, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Good to see all of you. I miss being on a health committee, though I imagine you guys are very busy at this time. House File 1825, what it does is it creates a legislative task force to look at the background, to look at the eligibility and the disqualifications that we have currently in statute. The last time we really did a look at this statute for DHS background checks was in 2003. What we know, and if members referenced in their packet, there are many stories about minor infractions that maybe happen on someone's criminal history that disqualify them from being care providers or working in certain fields because of this. One story SEIU included in the letter was that of Emily, who had check fraud on her record and lost her job at a clinic. So what this does essentially is creates a task force. I have been in contact with the counties. They have a place on this task force, and it is bipartisan in the Senate. And my goal is to make it bipartisan in the House. After we think slow down a little bit, I will be in contact with many members. But it is a pretty straightforward bill. It has 24 members on the membership, and I've been in contact with DHS, who also will have presence on this. And so, Madam Chair, I would go to my testifiers. I think that their stories are really imperative.
Thank you, Representative Edelson. The first testifier is Todd Gremenz. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and affiliation and then proceed with your testimony. And unmute yourself.
Absolutely, thank you. My name is Todd Gremenz. Thank you, Madam Chair, and for allowing us to be heard on this. I think it is a very personal touch, you know, to be able to testify to actual people's testimony and how this truly affects people. This program, this kind of was derived from DHS holding on to people's background records for lengthy periods of time, especially for people that have committed nonviolent offenses. What are creative ways to truly succeed and to help our communities right now with COVID-19 drastically harming our communities? We've seen it lead over into the PCA community. For example, someone who is a PCA being blocked from licensing from something as like a drug charge. So something that was a nonviolence offense, but also has then hindered the work livelihood of many people. And as you can imagine, what a PCA worker does is take care of people who are in these like vulnerable positions without care or help. This will help alleviate some of those opportunities. As likewise, real estate, being a realtor, any type of nonviolent offense, there's things such as this that really hold people back from expanding, being able to push into their careers. Being the leader of Black Lives Matter, St. Paul, this is a real testimony as to things that we have to do that have been plaguing our community, in a sense, to just at least create a task force to review these kind of things, inclusive of House committee. So as it's structured, there's 14 different positions that are cumulative of a majority and then a minority whip holder having the opportunity of both Democrat and Republican to play a part in figuring out unique ways to review this, to take a look at DHS and some of the practices that would alleviate us building a better bridge for our communities to get people in workforce and truly help. So I just want to definitely yield my time back to giving other testifiers time, but it's very structured in a sense to be inclusive of doing more research into how we can fix things.
Thank you, Mr. Gremenz. Let's see, next testifier I have is Ron Elwood from Legal Aid. Welcome, Mr. Elwood. Please proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. Ron Elwood from Legal Aid, and I'm here to testify today in support of House File 1825, and I want to thank and commend Representative Edelson for authoring this bill. DHS background studies, of course, serve an important purpose in ensuring vulnerable populations, including minors and older Minnesotans, are not placed at risk by those who would be their caretakers and service providers. But workers in these fields are disproportionately low-wage workers, workers of color, and legal aid clients. And while safety, of course, of our youth and elders is paramount, at the same time, we have seen too many instances where, based on current law, would-be workers who we can show are deserving are disqualified. It is here where the task force's mission of identifying existing statutes' weaknesses, inefficiencies, unintended consequences, and areas for improvement or modernization resonates most strongly for our clients. As in all areas of the law, we always seek the proper balance of interests. As veterans of the legislative process know all too well, task forces are often a place to punt a controversial issue and where solutions potentially go to die. But other times, task forces can be the ideal venue to grapple with thorny issues with competing, though equally legitimate, interests. And I firmly believe that this task force fits in that latter category. In closing, I want to thank Representative Edelson for the DE amendment that includes Minnesota Legal Services Coalition on the task force. We have significant experience in this area and look forward to being an active and constructive contributor to the end product. And thank you very much for allowing me to testify in support of House File 1825 today.
Thank you, Mr. Elwood. Representative Edelson, we don't have, it's a blank appropriation. Do you have an idea of the estimate for the cost of this?
Sorry, I was muted. Madam Chair, I do not at this time. I don't know if fiscal staff have any.
No, I'm just wondering if you had an estimate. If not, we'll wait for the fiscal note. Thank you, Representative Edelson. Questions from members? Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning, Representative Edelson. I'm looking at your DE amendment, and so if you could pull that up, we'll be referring to that.
I have it, Representative Albright.
Thank you. Just talking about the membership of the committee, it's very expansive. I'm wondering if you could give some detail in terms of the determination of the members that were included. I'm wondering, and I don't see it, but you can certainly point to it. I don't see any representation on this commission from law enforcement. Is that true?
Representative Edelson.
One moment. No, Madam Chair.
Representative Edelson.
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, on line 1.22, two members representing county attorneys and law enforcement is noted there.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, other questions from members? Not seeing any. Representative Edelson, any closing comments?
Madam Chair and members, we took the legislative task force approach, Senator Abler and I, though I know we're not supposed to mention the other body. We took this approach knowing that this is a controversial issue. There are definitely parts of the current statute that are there to protect people and that we absolutely must keep in there. But there are parts of the statute, of the 245 statute, that create massive barriers and that don't necessarily protect public safety. So I ask members for their support.
Thank you, Representative Edelson, and thank you to our testifiers. So House File 1825, as amended, will be laid over for possible inclusion in our finance omnibus bill. The next item for consideration is House File 1512. Representative Edelson, I'll move House File 1512 so it's before the committee, and it looks like you have an A1 amendment. So I'll move the A1 amendment. Want to briefly describe the amendment, please?
Yes, Madam Chair, the A1 amendment is after working with DHS to just make sure that we didn't go into other parts of statute that we weren't intending to.
Okay, members. Any questions on the A1 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of adopting the A1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, the motion prevails and the A1 amendment is adopted. To your bill as amended, Representative Edelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. House File 1512 would remove the requirement for DHS to do a background check on persons who already require a background check in the medical field that say work at outpatient surgery centers, hospitals, and other facilities that are licensed by MDH. Doctors and nurses would be a highlight from that statute that's listed within 214.01 subdivision 2. What we have done with this bill is we've worked with MDH as well as DHS, who are all here to answer any questions members may have. But essentially, right now, say a doctor that works in a hospital is required to do two background checks. So one for the licensing board and one for DHS, where say if that same another physician works at a clinic, they are not required to do both, just a one. And so for clarification, I'm happy to have Mary Krinke, my testifier, talk a little bit more about this. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Mendelson. Ms. Krinke, welcome to the committee. Please state your name and affiliation and then proceed.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee, and it's nice to be in this committee today. My name is Mary Krinke, and I'm with the Minnesota Hospital Association, and we support House Bill 1512. And as Representative Edelson said, what we're trying to do is really get at duplication that exists right now. If you are a licensed healthcare professional through your health professional licensing boards, like the Board of Nursing or Board of Medical Practice, you have to get a background check and a fingerprint there. And then similarly, you have to get that done with DHS. And what we're trying to say is that we think it is sufficient to get that done with the licensing boards and not have to go through a secondary background check and duplicative fingerprint with DHS. So for the other healthcare workers who do not have a professional license, they still are going through the DHS process. So I want to be clear, if you work in childcare or home care and you do not have a separate health license, you are still going through the DHS process. We think that one background check and one fingerprint is sufficient. I just want to give two quick examples, as Representative Edelson said. So let's say you are a nurse and you are working in a clinic setting and you accept a position to go work at a hospital all within the same health system. You're merely moving from a clinic setting to a hospital setting. You would then be required to get another background check and another fingerprint, even though you may be caring for the same individuals. We have also found, and I'd like to use this as my second example, we go to recruit a physician from out of state, and they would have to come to Minnesota, and of course, they would have to be credentialed as a physician in Minnesota. They would have to be licensed as a physician in Minnesota. They would have to get a background check and fingerprint, all with the Board of Medical Practices. But then they would also have to get that done with DHS. And so we have heard that this is a burden to these individuals to have to go through this process twice. It sometimes involves us having to fly these physicians in, putting them up in a hotel, and then literally having them get transportation to the limited fingerprinting places that are part of the DHS vendor. So we are trying to streamline this process. And also, the only other comment I want to make is, you all know right now, with the pandemic, the governor, through the executive orders, has put the fingerprinting and background check on hold. And there are now some approximately 200,000 people that may need to get a background check and fingerprint done within 60 days after the emergency powers end. And so we believe that by streamlining this process, that would at least ease some of the burden by taking some of those licensed healthcare professionals out of the DHS process. And we've been working very closely with MDH and DHS and hope that we can find something that everyone can agree to. We know of no opposition. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Krinke. Representative Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm wondering if either Ms. Krenke or Representative Edelson can answer this question, but we have a lot of nurses that go back and forth between North Dakota and Minnesota. Some I know are trained and licensed as they graduate from school, but would that also, what do I want to say? Would, if they had a North Dakota license, move to Minnesota, do they have to redo all of that, or could they bring that to Minnesota as they're working back and forth? I know we looked past that when we were having COVID issues, but I'm in support of trying to make this run much smoother. I think our PCAs, some of those areas, we're going to have some real problems when we strive to, as Mary Krenke said, get them up and licensed and not lose them in the process. So I certainly want people to have background checks. I you know, or make sure that we are licensed. But anyway, maybe Mary can respond to the nursing system.
Ms. Krenke?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, while the Minnesota Hospital Association certainly supports the multi-state nurse licensure compact, this is an entire issue. You still have to be a licensed nurse in good standing. So you still have to go to the Board of Nursing. You still have to be a licensed nurse. You still have to have a background check. You still have to have a fingerprint. You just don't have to have two done, okay? So I want to be clear. We support a background check and a fingerprint. We are trying to streamline it so that individuals don't have to go through this process twice. So regretfully, Representative Keel, to your question specifically, that individual would still have to be a licensed nurse in Minnesota. Okay.
Yep.
Thank you, Ms. Krenke. Chair Liebling?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I actually have more than one question about this, but here's the one that I'll ask. I'm looking at the language of the bill, and I know that the amendment struck one of the sections, but in the language of the bill on line 2.15, the paragraph that essentially is the meat of this, it says the commissioner is not required to conduct a background study. And then at the bottom, it says, unless the commissioner has reasonable cause to conduct a background study. Those things seem to me to be perhaps in conflict. If we're saying that the commissioner doesn't have to, that kind of would seem to give the commissioner the discretion not to. But then with this clause about has reasonable cause, it seems to limit the commissioner's discretion to have a background study if the commissioner, you know, for whatever reason, that there's some kind of standard. In other words, it almost seems like you're saying, instead of not required to, it almost seems like you're saying the commissioner may not, unless. So could you please explain why it's written that way and what that means?
Ms. Krenke?
I would actually like to phone a friend over at DHS, but I think we were trying to make it so that it would be potentially allowable, but would not be mandated that they do it. So, Madam Chair, I think that's my response, that it's not mandated that they have to get a dual fingerprint and background check, but if the commissioner thought it would be necessary, perhaps they worded that so that they still could ask for one under certain circumstances.
Chair Liebling, would you like DHS to comment on that?
Well, I think we need that, Madam Chair. I mean, if this is something that is potentially going to go forward, and it sounds like it actually needs more work, that it may be, because from what Ms. Krenke's comments, that I drew that probably DHS isn't quite comfortable with this yet, but it would seem to me that that last clause, the unless clause, would be not really relevant to this then, but probably we need DHS to comment on it. Thank you.
Mr. Burdick, would you like to comment or have someone on your team comment on this?
Madam Chair, that would be me, Kalani Moti with the Inspector General's Office.
Thank you, Ms. Moti. Please proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Chair Liebling. As I said, my name is Kalani Moti and I serve as the Inspector General at DHS, and one of the divisions within the Office of Inspector General is our background studies area on this. And with that, in order for us to do or to have any awareness of a reasonable cause, it would have to be somehow in our system. So in order to be able to implement this, there would have to be some sort of a data sharing agreement or agreement of sharing of information between us and the boards. And so in order to make us aware of it so that we could actually initiate a reasonable cause background studies, we would have to know about it. So there will likely be systems costs and implementation costs to be able to implement this as it's written.
Thank you.
So right now, the only way that we know if there's a reasonable cause is if it's in our system, and it would trigger that, and our system is all fingerprint based.
Thank you, Ms. Modi.
Madam Chair.
Ms. Representative Edelson.
Madam Chair, DHS and MDH and the stakeholders I've been working with are continuing to work on these. I mean, this is a very complicated bill. And so we have been engaging with them. And I just spoke with DHS yesterday. We are continuing to work on this because we don't want unintended consequences. So this is we almost have clarity around it.
Thank you, Representative Edelson. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Edelson, thank you for bringing this board bill forward. I think one of the purposes and one of the goals of this committee should be to look anytime that there is an opportunity to reduce the complexity for our frontline workers and our professionals to deliver the care that they've been trained to provide. And in the meantime, quite honestly, save not only the entities that they serve, but themselves, the funding, the monetary costs for these licenses and these background checks. And so I certainly recognize the concern that Representative Liebling raises, but in the overall perspective, as Representative Edelson has said, this is moving forward, and DHS is working to comply and make sure that there is quote unquote peace in the valley, if you will. It's an often used, overused term. Apologies. But to either the author of the bill or to Ms. Krinke, could you give me just a little more background in terms of, there are a couple of different, I know there is one for Department of Homeland Security, there's also FBI, and there's also our own Bureau of Criminal, the BCA, excuse me. What overlap is there in the various background studies that they would provide? And it certainly seems that the plurality of those is overwhelming from what I understand.
Well,
Edelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Representative Albright. We have been in contact with the BCA to look at if it was possible to actually have the BCA share the background, the fingerprint that they take, and share the data that they have with DHS to stop the duplication in that way. And that gets into data sharing, privacy issues. And so we have been in contact with the BCA, but what we found out is that information, to share it, is going to be very complicated, and going down that path is maybe not the best. Representative Bonner, you probably know why. With that, Mary Krinke, if you have any further information to add.
Ms. Krinke?
Madam Chair and members, I was just going to say, I believe them both to be a BCA fingerprint. I believe that both DHS and and the licensing boards use a BCA fingerprint.
Thank you, Ms. Krinke. Ms. Moti, could you comment on that, whether that would be in compliance with federal law if this bill was implemented?
Madam Chair, can I clarify, are you asking for because these are MDH-required studies, if it's going to be in comply with federal law for the MDH programs? If that's the question, that I wouldn't necessarily know. We have an agreement with MDH and doing it under their statutes, so I'm not certain. I'm assuming, and I know Representative Ellison has been in conversation with MDH regarding that. That was why we had offered the TA about removing it out of the DHS licensed programs and to not have that in there, because it will complicate with our federal requirements and our DHS licensed programs. And so that was the TA that we had provided. I can't speak for MDH, but I know Representative Ellison has been in contact and been working with them.
Representative Edelson?
Madam Chair, actually, I have Matt from MDH here who could speak to this.
I'm sorry, who do you want to speak to this, Representative Edelson?
Sorry, I'm looking for him to see if I see
it. Mr. Burdick?
No.
It's from DHS. Oh.
No, it's...
Do we have someone from MDH on the call with us? If not, I can follow up with my question later, Representative Edelson. That's fine.
I'm happy. Yes, and I'm happy to connect you. We have been in contact with MDH, and so I apologize that I thought he was going to be joining us today.
Okay, Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do see that representative from DHS, Mr. Burdick, is on the line. I was wondering if I could ask him a pointed question about this.
Be brief.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Burdick, we often deal with boards and their background checks in concert with what the DHS might also do for their background checks. Aren't they identical in most respects?
Mr. Burdick?
Madam Chair, Representative Albright. For the record, Matt Burdick with the Department of Human Services. I can take an attempt at this, but then might defer to my colleague, Inspector General Moti, who knows much more about this. My understanding is that there are some components of the DHS background study system that are a bit more robust in terms of automatic lookbacks and interface with court records. That said, as Inspector General Moti said earlier, DHS doesn't have any sort of policy opinion on this change, since we are just doing these checks on behalf of the Department of Health. And so to the extent that that meets the requirements for the health department, we wouldn't have any concern with that element of it.
Thank you, Mr. Burdick. Okay, closing comments, Representative Edelson.
And Madam Chair, it was Mark Schultz from MDH that I had asked to be here. And so I can have him follow up. He did look into the funding issue and that it would not be an issue, because that was one of our concerns, is to ensure that that was not going to be an issue. I ask members, just know that we will be continuing to work on this just for clarification, but it is a good bill. And the duplicative process really is unnecessary at this point. And I thank you for your time.
Okay, thank you, Representative Edelson, and thank you to Ms. Krinke for testifying today. With that, members, House File 1512 as amended will be laid over for possible inclusion in our Human Services Finance Bill. Thank you, Representative Edelson. Okay, next item is House File 2127. House File 2127, we're going to lay that over and take it up again tomorrow. So first it's going to be amended. There's an A21 amendment. So first I'll move House File 2127, so it's before the committee. Then I'll move the A21 amendment, which is the governor's supplemental budget. So if it's okay with members, we'll adopt that and then do the overview of the budget and supplemental budget. So all those in favor of adopting the A21 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Okay, the A21 amendment is adopted. Okay, so this, members, is the governor's budget. So we will hear an overview on each article. There are six articles of both the original budget and the supplemental budget. We will take testifiers, and there'll be more testifiers tomorrow. So we will just continue to take testimony tomorrow, and we will do the walkthrough by various individuals from DHS today. And I think I'll stop after each article to see if there is a clarifying question on one article. And then when we go to testifiers, if we have time, we can take questions after the testifiers have presented. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to DHS, and we have Jennifer Sommerfeld with us to go through Article 1. Ms. Sommerfeld?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning, members of the committee. I'm Jennifer Sommerfeld with Children and Family Services, and I'm going to walk you through Article 1 of the bill. So sections 1 through 3 are part of the proposal that is related to 6-month reporting and prospective budgeting. And this proposal, as we've talked about previously, will more effectively support participants, particularly those who are working, and simplify administration of the program. Sections 4 through 8 of the bill are from the SNAP employment and training proposal. These sections authorize DHS to administer the SNAP employment and training program in alignment with federal law. Section 9 of the bill is related to 6-month reporting. It removes language prohibiting MFIP households from aligning with SNAP's 6-month reporting requirements. Section 10 is from the Community Action Formula Change Proposal. It removes the lowest tier of base funding, which is currently $25,000 per year, and the Community Action Statute, and it allows all Community Action grantees to receive a minimum of $50,000 per year in base funding. Section 11 is from the proposal related to tribal access to food shelf and emergency assistance authority. The section adds federally recognized tribal nations to the list of organizations that qualify for state food shelf funding. Sections 12 through 23 are from the 6-month reporting proposal. Section 24 is from the proposal related to tribal access to food shelf and emergency assistance authority again. This portion amends the MFIP consolidated fund statute to clarify that tribal nations, just like counties that are administering eligibility for MFIP, can use the MFIP consolidated fund for emergency assistance payments to families in crisis. Sections 25 to 28 are from the North Star Federal Compliance Proposal. These sections ensure that state statutes are in compliance with federal law by eliminating a non-compliant statutory requirement in place right now that requires DHS to automatically offset a child's monthly North Star adoption assistance payment rather than negotiating with each family to set that rate. Sections 29 to 32 make various changes to put in place the 6-month reporting proposal. In addition, Section 32 clarifies that unemployment insurance should not be counted when determining eligibility for economic assistance if it's paid to somebody who's 18 or 19 and that person is enrolled in school at least half-time. Sections 33 to 35 are related to the 6-month reporting proposal. And Section 36 is various repealers related to the 6-month reporting and SNAP employment and training proposals. Turning to the supplemental budget amendment, starting at lines 1.2 to 16.26, these lines relate to maintaining family connections in foster care. They align foster care and adoption background studies requirements, and it's very similar to the language that you've heard previously in House File 1287. Lines 16.28 to 17.29 are from the Aligning Contradictions in Public Assistance Statutes. This language addresses some construction issues that are in the underlying budget bill and make sure there's appropriate interaction with other parts of the budget. Lines 18.1 to 18.11 are for the MFIP COLA proposal. Lines 18.12 to 22.20 align public assistance statutes again, that, as said previously, is just aligning language with other proposals and clearing up some construction issues in the bill. And then a very large block, lines 22.21 to 65.27, those are all related to the Maintaining Family Connections in Foster Care proposal. What they do at a high level is provide a series of policy clarifications and updates intended to ensure that local agencies and courts are focusing efforts on preventing removals of children from their homes. And when removal is necessary, that those same lead agencies and courts are focusing time and attention on engaging with the child's relatives or kin, and placing the child with the child's family rather than strangers. And that, in sum, is Article 1.
Thank you, Ms. Sommerfeld. And I'll just note to members that the bill index is on our committee website, so you can follow through the various articles and sections there. Representative Albright.
Madam Chair, and I don't know if anyone else is having difficulty. When I go to the link provided by your staff for the A1 to the 2127, it actually pulls up the A1 amendment to 1512. And so I've requested that it be resent. But I'm just wondering if anyone else is having difficulty accessing the A1 amendment to the governor's budget bill.
Representative Elbert, I'm just checking our website. Are you referring to the email that was sent by our committee administrator?
I am, Madam Chair.
Okay,
That's correct, Madam Chair. I'm having the same issue.
Okay, let me see if it's on our committee website.
And Madam Chair, as Ms. Sunderman went through the first couple of articles of the governor's budget bill, would those be reflective of before or after the adoption of the amendment?
I believe the articles she mentioned initially were in the original underlying bill, and then she mentioned the specific lines in the supplemental budget in the amendment. And the amendment is posted on our website. So if you need it immediately, our state will send it out via email, but it's also the correct one is on the committee website.
Madam Chair, I greatly appreciate if that could be resent just for the sake of time and looking between websites. I think it's important that we all have the most current information.
Will do, Representative Albright.
Thank you.
Okay, moving to the second article, Ms. Grom.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Christy Grom, and I'm with the Department of Human Services. So I will walk you through Article 2 of the bill, which deals with our community supports provisions. Sections 1, 18, 20, and 27 relate to the acuity-based customized living rates and closing the corporate foster care loophole proposal. These provisions limit new developments of customized living settings that serve four or fewer people on the CADI and BI waivers in a single-family home. They provide an exception for the corporate foster care licensing moratorium, allowing settings to transition to that licensure if indeed it's the correct licensure for them. And they also require a legislative report. Finally, the provisions require the commissioner to establish an acuity-based rate tool input limits based on case mix for customized living and for 24-hour customized living. Sections 2, 7, 8, and 29 relate to our substance use disorder reform package. These sections remove rate add-ons for Medicaid substance use disorder services for providers who serve parents with children, culturally specific populations, people with co-occurring disorders, and people with medical complexity. This is an administrative simplification and a cost savings item. They limit outpatient SUD services to bill for only 6 hours per day or up to 30 hours per week, or if a person needs more than that, their practitioner could request a prior authorization from the department. They provide access to a rate, an increased rate, and require residential SUD treatment providers to enroll in the 1115 SUD demonstration by January 1 of 2022. And finally, they require the commissioner to evaluate opioid treatment programs, the rate structure in those programs, and make recommendations to the legislature on an unbundled revised rate structure. This is related to an OLA recommendation. Sections 3, 4, and 5 relate to the Opiate Epidemic Response Advisory Council. These provisions update the OREC, the council, to include a voting member from each Minnesota tribal nation. They also change the OREC grant cycle from fiscal year to calendar year. Sections 6, 9, 13, and 14 deal with our case management redesign proposal. These sections establish a policy direction for targeted case management. They ensure federal compliance requirements are met for targeted case management. They require the commissioner to set a statewide rate methodology for subcontracted county targeted case management, and they also set caseload size limits for targeted case management. Sections 10, 11, 12, 15, 16, 17, and 26 relate to our Waiver Reimagined Phase 2 proposal. These provisions remove county-based allocations for the DD, CADI, CAC, and BI home and community-based service waivers. They require the commissioner to seek federal approval for our waiver reconfiguration from 4 waivers down to 2 waivers, as well as for the individualized budgeting methodology for the waivers. Sections 24 and 25 relate to our tribal cost-neutral housing support allocation proposal. These sections clarify that tribes are eligible for the cost-neutral transfers from the housing support fund and for housing support supplementary service rates. This is a streamlined process
which counties currently have access to, but tribes do not. So we are ensuring that they do under this proposal. Section 28 relates to the self-directed workforce union contract. This section provides Medicaid rate increases to cover the wage floor and other negotiated terms that are a part of the SEIU healthcare collective bargaining agreement with the state for personal care assistance choice programs, CDCS, consumer-directed community supports, and consumer support grant programs. And then Section 30 is a host of repealers. There's a repealer related to our case management redesign provisions. There's also a repealer related to the disability service grant reduction, repealing the state quality council provision, which is no longer a functioning council. There's a repealer related to the SUD rate add-ons as part of the SUD reform package. And then a repealer for county waiver allocation requirements that are part of the waiver reimagined package. Moving to the amendment, lines 68.8. Starting on line 68.8, there's an update to the legislative report requirement for the ORAC, the Opioid Epidemic Response Advisory Council, which changes a legislative report requirement from March to December. This is adhering to a timeline that aligns with when we'll know how much funding has accumulated in the opiate fund, so we can therefore know how much funding is available to the council to make grant recommendations. Line 68.9 to 68.19, these are changes related to the SUD reform proposal that would allow the commissioner to grant an exception of up to 6 months to providers who encounter barriers in complying with the American Society of Addiction Medicine standards that are required under the 1115 demonstration waiver. And also adds an effective date that would be contingent on federal approval for that provision. Line 68.21 to 68.27 provides some clarifying language in response to concerns that we heard related to the individualized budgeting methodology under the waiver reimagined proposal. Just clarifying that that individualized budgets in this proposal is not intending to push people into one waiver or another, and that it's subject to a person's person-centered support planning process, as well as to the independent living first policy established under 256B.4905. Those were provisions that passed last session related to disability policy statements. Lines 69.1 to 70.10. These are provisions in the supplemental budget that add cost reporting for personal care assistance and community first services and supports. So essentially this provision requires DHS to evaluate PCA and CFSS rates and requires agencies to submit cost reporting data such as wages, benefits, executive wages, administrative costs, et cetera. This provision also requires the commissioner to develop and implement a technical assistance process that supports agencies in this cost reporting process, and that focuses particularly on smaller agencies and agencies where English is a second language and agencies that serve BIPOC communities. Lines 70.11 to 70.23 also relate to the PCA cost reporting, which I mentioned previously. These provisions require a legislative report every 2 years to provide information to the legislature on the costs noted to in the cost reporting process to provide the personal care assistance and community first services and supports. Services. Line 70.24 is a tribal cost neutral allocation clarification, just removing the word county so that we can clarify that tribes also have access to this process. And then line 70.26 to 71.4, I will turn over to my colleague, Assistant Commissioner Pollack, to describe briefly.
Thank you, Ms. Grum. Mr. Pollack.
Hi, good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. So let me back up on the author's amendment. We're starting on page 66, line 17. The following sections are bill language related to the one governor's supplemental item related to nursing home resident assessments that I presented in committee already. I think you're muted, Madam Chair.
Oh, okay. I'm just talking to my son, sorry.
Okay. I wanna make sure I was paying attention. And so this is the this is the provision we presented that's in the tracking now that relates to somebody who their case mix condition changes sooner than 90 days. So the language describes requiring an assessment and then changing the billable rate to reflect their actual need for therapy or their actual need for isolation in a shorter time period. I think the only other piece that Ms. Grom wanted me to present on is, sorry, I'm just looking for the language on customized living. Oh, okay, page 70, line 26. This is a conforming piece of language related to the assisted living licensure law. And so what we're doing here is clarifying that in order to continue to receive customized living services, payments in Medicaid for waiver services, a provider has to either meet the licensure law, the new licensure law that's taking effect this summer, which is 144G, or alternatively, they can be licensed as a comprehensive home care provider under Chapter 144A, which is the MDH licensing law for home care services, or that they're providing services in a setting that is exempt from the license, Clause 11 to 13. And so this is important to continue Medicaid payment for customized living services for organizations that are in assisted living or providing assisted living services.
Okay, Ms. Grom.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Mr. Pollack. Just a couple of more provisions in the amendment for my area to go over. So line 71.5 to 71.8, simply add the SEIU self-directed worker collective bargaining agreement ratification language. Line 73.17 to 74.8 relate to the IMD and MAT overpayments. So these are new provisions in the governor's supplemental budget that appropriate funding to counties and tribal nations to hold them harmless for the department overpayment errors that occurred in the past. And that is all I have for members. I'm happy to answer any questions. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, any clarifying questions? Representative Albright.
Madam Chair, and I'm not sure Mr. Pollack or Mr. Grom would be pertinent to this question, but in Article 2, we're talking about rate reform from remote services. Does that relate to DDWRS rates?
Ms. Grom?
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, yes, it does relate to DWRS rates.
Representative Albright?
Clarifying question then. I know in past conversations, it has been my understanding that we were trying to move towards parity between those and other rates, but it would appear from this proposal that those DWRS rates are actually being reduced. Am I correct in that assumption, or am I reading it wrong?
Ms. Grom?
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, you are correct. This would result in a creating separate rate frameworks for certain services under DWRS. So for day services, pre-vocational services, unit-based services with and without programming. And essentially these would be separate frameworks that would pay the cost that would be incurred when those services are provided remotely. It is the result of some conversations we've had with the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services over the past several months, which have been varied conversations. We're still seeking clarity from CMS on whether or not we need to adjust our rate frameworks for remote provision of these services. So there's still some unanswered questions as it relates to this proposal. So we continue to monitor the issue closely and work with CMS on it as well as with providers.
Representative Albright.
Madam Chair and Ms. Grom, as you are well aware, this has been an issue of great debate over the last several biennium, and particularly with regard to the compensation and care provided to those that are the most vulnerable amongst us. So I appreciate your notation that you are undertaking ongoing conversations as this committee will, and I look forward to hearing hopefully a positive outcome from those conversations for the benefit of those that not only provide the care, but for those that receive the care that is so desperately needed in this state for those individuals. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Albert. And I know we have Mr. Greenman here from DHS to talk about the fiscal piece. So if members have questions about that, we can do, I think we'll go to, if Ms. Grom doesn't have a response or is finished with the walkthrough, we will go to testifiers to make sure we get all the testimony in. Ms. Grom, is that okay with you?
Madam Chair, that works great. Perfectly for me.
Thank you. So the first testifier is Bill Messenger. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and affiliation for the record and then proceed with your testimony. And unmute yourself, please.
There we go. You ready? Hi.
Please proceed.
Chairwoman Schultz and committee members, thank you for the opportunity to speak today. My name is Bill Messenger, and I'm affiliated with the Coalition of Recovery Investment, and we've been working for the last 7-8 years on trying to increase funding for SUD services and also improve policy. So for the past few years, we've been working on the opioid bill and the 1115 waiver, and the idea was to try to increase the amount of money that's coming into the state budget to better serve people with substance use disorders, including the population that is kind of chronic in the jail system, in the hospital system, or on the streets. And would like to comment that we've been disappointed that the governor's budget actually cut funding for SUD services at a time when needs are increasing substantially. And we now note that there's a lot of COVID money coming in and other money available, and we think now's the time to increase funding, not cut funding. And we're particularly interested in increasing services for people who need wraparound, consistent treatment management, and that includes the RCOs, the recovery coaches. It includes the healthcare navigators, a number of improvements that we think the system needs, including additional funding in order to improve services to this a group of people who are now underserved and suffering in our community. So with that, we'd like to be able to make comments in the future on increases in the budget. Now that Governor Walz apparently is opening up that issue for committee members like yourselves to focus on these unmet needs. So with that, I will thank you for granting me the time to testify, and we'll submit something further to the committee. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Messenger. The second testifier we have is John Magnuson of March. Welcome to the committee. Please proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Schultz and members of the committee, for the privilege of testifying before you today. My name is John Magnuson, Executive Director of MARCH, Minnesota Association of Resources for Recovery and Chemical Health. MARCH is a statewide professional association of addiction treatment professionals and organizations striving to raise awareness about addiction and the power of recovery. We work to improve access to quality behavioral health services for all Minnesotans who need support and share the value of long-term recovery to the individual, family, and the communities we live in. Our three overriding public policy goals this biennium are increasing access to treatment, strengthening the SUD and mental health workforce, and creating sustainability for the behavioral health continuum of care. The governor's proposed budget as presented has the very real possibility of challenging all three and destabilizing the provider base already compromised by the stress of the COVID pandemic. While we deal with historic spikes in overdoses, suicides, opioid and meth and alcohol abuse. Therefore, we oppose the governor's proposed budget for SUD as it mandates an unrealistic timeframe for enrollment in the 1115 demo, proposes cuts to existing enhanced rates for co-occurring mental health, medical necessity, women and children, and culturally specific programs, and lacks the necessary transition supports, technical assistance, and grants needed to be successful in the implementation of the demo. March has continued our bipartisan consensus-building approach to finding solutions with House and Senate committees, DHS, mental health colleagues, RCOs, schools, and other partners in the behavioral health continuum as we work to resolve issues and improve the opportunity for Minnesota to be successful in the 1115 demo. The March alternative framework of solutions includes a more realistic timeframe to onboard the 1115 demo, retains the enhanced rates until rate reform is complete, and provides technical assistance, rate adjustments, and grants to fill gaps that improve quality and expand access. Fully funds and completes the necessary regulatory reforms underway. In closing, these solutions are mostly agreed upon by all parties as necessary to build an evidence-based, patient-centered, fully integrated behavioral health continuum of care for the people of Minnesota. Even better, the resources to do them exist right now due to many one-time opportunities of federal funds for SUD from the CMS 1115 demo, the SAMHSA block grants, the American Recovery Act, and the COVID-19 relief funds. Therefore, we urge the committee to please support the March alternative framework of solutions and keep funds meant for SUD in service to the needs of SUD. Thanks, Chair Schultz and the committee for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Mr. Magnuson. The third testifier we have is Marty Paulson. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and affiliation for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Chair Schultz and committee members, thank you for allowing me to testify today. My name is Marty Paulson, and I'm the Executive Director of Project Turnabout Centers for Addiction Recovery, headquartered in Granite Falls, Minnesota. I am also privileged to be the President of the Minnesota Alliance of Rural Addiction Treatment Providers, of which I am here representing today. In May of 2018, nine Minnesota substance use treatment providers voluntarily worked extremely hard and long to meet the requirements of the 1115 demonstration project. Five of those nine providers were rural in locations and members of the Minnesota Alliance. We were told then that due to the federal funds this waiver allows, it would save the state 94% of the expenses related to substance use disorder at the time. We were also told that this project would bring 15% increase in revenue to residential programs and a 10% increase in revenue to outpatient treatment services programs. These increases would help us to cover the costs of the increase in staffing requirements that are written into the waiver. Never were we told this project would become mandatory. Never were we told all providers would be mandated to provide certain programs and/or certain medications. Never have we been told the state would be taking away the added enhancement rates we all had been receiving. This loss would range from 6% to 24% revenue, depending upon how many enhancements the provider was currently taking on. Hence, a provider could ultimately lose their revenue by 9%. Is there really parity in any of these mandates? And all of this is coming at a time when, unfortunately, over the last 12 months, COVID-19 has unintentionally created significant consequences for those in need of substance use treatment disorder. The state of Minnesota has seen a 31% increase in overdose deaths since March of 2020. Treatment centers have seen a dangerous reduction in the number of beds available and a significant shortage of staff. Loss of regular support meetings, isolation, loneliness, no structure, and a fear to reach out for help has created a perfect storm with no lifeline. If the governor's proposed budget goes through as written, we will lose revenue, we will lose treatment beds, and treatment centers will close. Quality of services will be reduced, and the people of Minnesota still in need of help will suffer. Now is not the time to take funds away from us. We need your support. I thank you for allowing me to testify today.
Thank you, Ms. Paulson, for your testimony. The last testifier I have is Sadie Brockemeyer. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and affiliation and then proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chairwoman Schultz and the members of the committee for allowing me time to discuss the impact that the removal of the enhanced rate will have on family treatment. My name is Sadie Brockemeyer, and I'm the Executive Director of Recovering Hope Treatment Center in Mora, Minnesota. Recovering Hope Treatment Center is a 108-bed residential facility for substance use. We are proud to be a for-profit treatment provider in the world of nonprofits. We have a sustainable business model that's not reliant on grant funding. We provide over 87 full-time jobs with benefits, and we pay over $125,000 annually in property taxes that provides resources to our poverty-driven community. We are one of five family treatment providers in the state of Minnesota, and we want to make sure that our small voice is not lost in the discussion of the governor's budget. Family-based treatment is an evidence-based approach that allows for women and children, and pregnant women to seek services for substance use. The Department of Human Services acknowledges that the best approach to serving families is to keep them together. Currently, our center is able to receive funding through the enhanced modifier rates for medical modifiers to be able to better serve our pregnant women, and mental health modifier to be able to serve the mental health needs and trauma and domestic violence that a lot of our women have, and also to be able to allow for funding for the mother to come to treatment with their child, whether that child is brand new, 1 day old, well, usually 2 days, 2 days old or 5 years old. Mom is able to remain connected with their family system. I know that others have testified and advocated for more common modifiers of the medical and the mental health, the special populations. However, even though the women and children modifier is the least used, to me, it's by far the most important. To serve children, we receive $5.37 per family, not per child, to allow them to come to services with their mother. If a woman comes to our facility with more than one child, we still receive the same enhanced rate. This enhanced rate is to cover the cost of our fully licensed daycare, additional staff to help with parenting and children, the cost of meals, and incidentals that have come with having children on site. More toys, more activities, formula, diapers. We are already underfunded, and the Department of Services would like to take away the funding that we do have. This rate increase is disguised as a good thing and a strong increase in funding, when the reality for centers like ours, we will be taking a rate loss. The cost will not be a savings. It will be moved directly to the child protection system and the foster care system. We currently receive about $161.10 per month to have a child on site. And if we are no longer able to operate as a family treatment provider, the state of Minnesota will end up having to fund foster care services for the children we currently serve at the rate of $695 to $2,291 a month. On the 23rd, I attended a meeting with the March Committee and Department of Human Services. A member of the Department of Human Services was asked if the removal of the enhanced rate would water down substance use treatment centers. And she stated it would not. This is false information stated from those who are not directly working in the substance use facilities here in Minnesota. From a business model, it would not make sense for me to continue to serve children. We would lose all the funding we have for children on site when we could financially serve 108 single women and be fully funded instead of 74 women and 34 unfunded children. This is not the model of care we want. Does not match our mission and value to not serve women and children. Again, we are one of five treatment providers in the state of Minnesota, and we are currently the largest treatment provider for families. During the pandemic, we already suffered the loss of Journey Home in St. Cloud, which was one of the largest providers that had been around for about 60 years. They shut their doors in June of 2020 due to financial concerns, leaving a gap in services for women and children. I hope that as the budget is reviewed, that you'll continue to prioritize funding for substance use treatment and not remove the enhanced rates. The decision to remove the rates will water down services and directly impact the availability of family treatment. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Brockmeyer, for your testimony. That is the end of our list of testifiers for today, so I will open up to members. Chair Fisher may want to make a comment about the testifiers. Chair Fisher?
Thank you, Chair Schultz. I want to say thank you to the testifiers for their input that they've been providing. I do know that on the 1115 project that there's a group working between the providers and with the Department of Human Services. And I do know that there's some updates that we're supposed to be getting on that later on this evening. And the question I would have to the providers and to the department, how do we seem to be moving along? Do you folks feel comfortable that we're making good progress along the lines here?
Thank you. So let's turn over to DHS if they can first address that. And then did you have a specific testifier in mind that you wanted to ask that question to?
I was thinking that more toward Mr. Magnuson.
So Mr. Magnuson or DHS, if you want to start to address Chair Fisher's question.
I'll be happy to follow your direction and let DHS go first.
Sure. Ms. Graham?
Madam Chair, Representative Fisher, we are having conversations with MARCH, and we've been having those conversations throughout the course of the past several months, having weekly meetings, sometimes several meetings a day with MARCH to discuss the proposal, a lot of clarifications being made, and really listening to their concerns and wanting to make sure that at the end of the day, what this proposal amounts to is improved quality of substance use disorder treatment in the state. I think we all have that shared and collective vision. And we do continue to meet with MARCH, and I think we are making progress in kind of where some of the barriers might be in terms of what proposal they put forward, and also where some of the opportunities are and where we could meet them a little bit closer to what they were hoping to accomplish this session.
Thank you, Ms. Graham. Mr. Magnuson.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair, and to the department. We have been participating, and we are grateful for the technical assistance that DHS has been providing. I'll restate that we've been working in a bipartisan way with all stakeholders to bring forward a set of solutions rather than a set of problems, and that we have mostly agreed upon by all parties as necessary to build an evidence-based, patient-centered, fully integrated behavioral health care continuum of care. MARCH is committed to that, and we continue to work in that bipartisan spirit of collaboration. There are needs that are existing for the field to be successful in actually implementing what the governor's budget is calling for. And we are optimistic that we will find a way to make sure that those needs are covered so that providers and others can be successful in implementing that shared vision for all of us. So thank you for the opportunity. And thank you again to Chair Fisher for helping to carry those conversations on and the others at the department.
Thank you, Mr. Magnuson, and thank you, Ms. Graham, for working with Chair Fisher on this issue, and we look forward to seeing what you can accomplish this week. Are there any other questions from members? Representative Albright?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'm not sure who to direct this to, but in concert with the bill itself, I'm looking to the spreadsheet, the proposal tracking spreadsheet, and I'm looking at line 156. With regard to the description says in addressing the SNAP error rate, and I'm reminded that I was informed some time ago that there is an error rate of 10% within the SNAP program. I'm wondering if someone could speak to that and what corrective measures have been taken to address that issue.
Let's see, would this be for Ms. Graham or Ms. Sommerfeld? Ms. Sommerfeld?
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, I'm going to defer to Tiki Brown, who's our SNAP manager.
Ms. Brown?
Good afternoon. For the record, Tiki Brown with the Minnesota Department of Human Services. To your question, yes, we in SNAP do have a high error rate, one that has been increasing over time. At this point in time, we are on a process with USDA to take corrective actions, such as meeting with the counties and tribes that have a high error rate, working with them to put in place some mitigation efforts. And also the department has assigned a staff person to work on a payment accuracy effort to help mitigate and hone in on the top errors that we do have at this time.
Thank you, Ms. Brown. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Brown, you mentioned that it's been increasing over time. Could you elaborate in terms of how long this issue has plagued the department?
Ms. Brown.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. This error rate, I don't have the exact time frame, but we do. This isn't a method that we work with the U.S. Department of Agriculture and review over every single year. And certainly over the past several years, we have seen that error rate creep up. And there are a number of reasons for that, some of which are explained in our proposal that we would like to mitigate. Working on our technology systems, providing more technical assistance to our counties and tribes. But it is a rate that, due to some of the complexity of our systems and some of the extra steps that our counties and tribes must take, this does increase our error rate over time.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Brown, I appreciate the response. Because this is a federal program as well, coordinated with our state agencies, it's eerily reminiscent, and I'm not trying to throw out any pejoratives here, to the error that we certainly are trying to address with regard to the antagonist for opioid addiction on some of those issues on the federal level. Is the federal Department of Agriculture looking for clawback on some of these overpayments, or what really is the issue here? And are we looking at a federal, demand for repayment of those overpayments? Could you give me a little more elaboration? I really appreciate your assistance in this matter.
Ms. Brown.
Certainly, Madam Chair and Representative Albright. We are currently in first year liability status, which means we have been put on notice by the Department of Agriculture that unless we improve our rate, we in fact will be granted a sanction. That sanction is a formula that USDA does put in place, and we don't know the exact amount that we would be sanctioned. Until we are in that situation. I will say, because of the pandemic, we have been granted a reprieve, all states in the nation, due to just the unusual nature of the pandemic. And so no sanction has been put in place for this year. We are at risk for sanction during the next time frame.
Thank you, Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Brown, has the Department of Agriculture informed you of what an acceptable range of error would be to be alleviated or be removed from that sanction status?
Ms. Brown?
Madam Chair and Representative, yes, although that rate does change from year to year, the U.S. Department of Agriculture takes the in account all of the states across the nation, the error rate, and they put together an average. It's expected to be in the 6% range, although it does vary from year to year.
Representative Albright.
Madam Chair and Ms. Brown, under the provisions of that line item in the proposal tracking, is that intended to just recover the excess, or are we really trying to get at what is wrong with the system and take corrective actions. I know one issue is to kind of just gloss it over, but I appreciate your tenacity in trying to correct it. Obviously, we don't want to have sanctions imposed upon us, but how long do we have in order to remedy this situation before Washington would take further actions toward your agency?
Ms. Brown?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the timeframe is a little bit convoluted. We do get notified each June of our potential error rate, upon which USDA would notify us if we were in sanction status or not. Again, because of the pandemic, we won't be notified this June, but rather June of 2022. So we have a period of time to make those corrections. And the proposals that we have put forth in this proposal are based on conversations we've had with counties and tribes, things that would make their work easier, so that would mitigate some of the errors, as well as increase our capacity at the state level to provide the technical assistance that they have requested.
Thank you, Ms. Brown. Representative Rasmussen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll seek your advice, Madam Chair, as to who would be best to direct my question to, but I know we're getting more numbers on the American Rescue Plan and you have the $8 billion that the state of Minnesota will be receiving. And it's my understanding from reviewing some information that has been put out by MMB that there's quite a bit of dollars that are focused in on the work of this committee in terms of human services. Just a couple examples, there's a mental health block grant, substance abuse block grant, you know, that would touch on some of the items that we've talked about today. And so, Madam Chair, I was wondering if perhaps there was someone from DHS, perhaps Mr. Burdick, who could comment on how DHS and the governor is thinking about leveraging those funds that are available to potentially fund, you know, the governor's budget priorities that have been presented here today.
Thank you, Representative Rasmussen. It does sound like a lot of money, $8 billion, but a lot of that money, remember, is going to our local and county units of government. We have about $2.6 billion coming to the state. That's somewhat unrestricted, but a lot of it also is in HHS through grants that is very restricted. So we're still learning about all of those funding opportunities for the state, especially in Health and Human Services. And I believe either Mr. Burdick or Mr. Greenman can probably help address that. Mr. Greenman?
Excuse me, Madam Chair, Dave Greenman, Budget Director with the Department of Human Services. Thank you for the question. The state has received about, of the $8 billion, I think we can sort of put it into the amount that is in front of that the Department of Human Services is dealing with is a portion of the $2.6 billion in federal recovery funds that go to the state would potentially go to services and programs administered by DHS. I mean, these are more flexible dollars that can be used to address COVID. And then as Representative Rasmussen mentioned, there's a variety of programmatic grants that go directly to DHS for specific purposes. That's a total of about $640 million that went to DHS. And we will be, we're looking right now at, are there opportunities to leverage some of that funding to help with addressing the governor's budget, and also to, as we're going through the planning process, looking at how those dollars can support and enhance the work we're currently doing with the governor's budget as a partner in that. And we'll be doing outreach as we do this planning and certainly looking for input from legislators on how we would want to spend those dollars. But at this point, we don't have a lot of information yet. It passed less than 2 weeks ago, so we're still waiting to hear from the federal government sort of what kind of limitations there are on how we can spend money.
Thank you, Mr. Greenman. Representative Rasmussen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. Greenman. I appreciate that and understand that a lot of the guidance, you know, from the federal government is still being written and issued as to how these funds, you know, can be utilized. So I appreciate the complexity and the move, you know, how quick moving this is. I would appreciate if DHS would, you know, keep us up to date with, you know, how these dollars can potentially be used, because I think we do have an opportunity to, you know, leverage these dollars to meet, you know, some of our shared priorities. And then the last comment I would make is, yeah, I would just really implore the governor to work through the legislative process when it comes to deciding how these dollars are going to be spent. I think, you know, Chair Schultz and members of this committee, you know, have done a lot of thoughtful work, a lot of research, you know, Chair Fisher and his group. And I would have a strong preference as a member of the legislature to see these dollars actually go through our legislative process to be distributed, because I just think there's a lot of expertise and time and perspectives that are tapped going through the legislative process. And so that would just be something I'd leave DHS with, and also the leadership of this committee. But thank you very much for the thorough presentation of the governor's budget priorities today.
Thank you, Representative Rasmussen. And I'll just remind members and people of Minnesota who are watching that they should, I encourage them to go stream the Ways and Means Committee hearing from Monday, where we got a walkthrough from MMB about the federal money and where it would be going and where it's earmarked for the schools, for mental health, for behavioral health, for substance abuse treatment. It's very enlightening to see a lot of that money is designated for significant important for childcare, but also for state and local units, and then some for HHS. Okay, any other questions from members? Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just in preparation for tomorrow, wondering what the schedule will be with regard to reviewing the governor's proposal. There is a spreadsheet and certainly because of our financial authority over this, I'm just wondering what depth we'll take into that, as well as any remaining bills that might be heard tomorrow going into the final deadline. So appreciate your comments on those.
Thank you, Representative Albright. So tomorrow we're going to continue taking public testimony on the governor's budget and supplemental budget. We can have Mr. Greenman with us to walk through the fiscal notes or the financial aspect of the governor's budget and supplemental budget, although we did have an overview last week on that as well. We can take members' questions on that fiscal component. We are not hearing other bills besides the governor's budget and supplemental budget on Thursday. On Friday, we will convene at 10:30 a.m., and so far we have four bills on the agenda for Friday, so we can make deadline. So I think that should answer your question, Representative Albright, but just keep checking your email if things change, and we will send notices via email. Any other questions?
Madam Chair, if I might.
Go ahead, Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I referenced a spreadsheet that I'm not sure if your committee staff shared with the rest of the members. I'm wondering if that could be resent, just to put it at the top of the stack for people as we go through the financials tomorrow. I think it's imperative that we discern, as Representative Jordan, I think, really eloquently laid out the import of where these monies are coming from, whether they are coming from general fund, from cancellations from other programs, or from the Repair America Act. Probably not using that correctly, but just so that we are mindful and being diligent about our responsibility to be good stewards. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Albright. We will send that out from Doug Berg, I believe it came from. If you're referring to a different one, just shoot me an email. But we will do that on tomorrow. Some members have that at the top of their inbox. I'm not seeing any other questions from members, so we will convene tomorrow at 10:30 our normal time, and then on Friday again at 10:30. So with that, members, thank you for being with us all morning. We appreciate your time, and I look forward to seeing everyone tomorrow. And with that, we are adjourned.